want to apologize officially, particularly from the entities, because when we changed the time yesterday to say you are starting at 10, it looks like some of them did not get that communication from the department officials that were here. Assumption was that that should have been communicated, because when we were finishing yesterday, we made an announcement that we are starting at 9. We started at 10 because of other arrangements that we had in the morning. But it has still come to my knowledge that they've been here since 9 o'clock, waiting and getting confused whether we are coming or not. I want you to start the meeting louder. The only thing that stopped them, that they couldn't correct. But we thank you very much for, we just want to apologize on that. We had hoped that the Minister of Human Development would probably make an appearance just to greet and go, but there's an urgent cabinet meeting in place right now that she's attending. So she finishes early, she might just pop in, but we're not promising. So there's also a confusion from the honorable members of four entities that are being presenting today. The four entities that are presenting today, NHDRC, Grants, NHFC, and NATURE. Now, confusion seems to stem from the fact that the initial capital agenda that went out yet, it did not have NHDRC, but it was since amended and sent back again. So the NHDRC is the first entity that is presenting today. So I just wanted to clear that confusion on everybody. It is presented to the initiative. Honorable Sitos, it is presented to the No, we will make you give you copies. We will make a plan. Is there extra copies? Because where are you going to send it? You can send it from home. No, the presentation is going to be only in there anyway. You will follow it. So those are the four entities that are going to start. Now, without wasting any time, we welcome everybody. We welcome the officials from the entities. We welcome the officials from the department. And we are going to start straight away. And Mr. Mani, are you ready? Can we hand over to you? Can we please do this quietly? Now we have the meeting at that end. Thank you very much, honorable members. We are starting with NHDRC.
Chair, good morning, and to members and other colleagues here. Chair, I have the acting chairperson of NHDRC, Mr. Ebichane, who is accompanying us today. He's just going to do some opening remarks, and then I'll start with the presentation. So I'll just hand over to him, as this is actually his first meeting that is attending the portfolio committee. Chairperson.
Thank you, Phil. Chair, ladies and gentlemen, as indicated, my name is Ayi Chikane, and I do say to the chair that I'm brand new as the chair of the NHDRC. To be more precise, I'm actually the acting chair for the next month or so as our board's term is coming to an end. And I didn't think I should waste your time, even though I've spent the whole of the past month or so reading and trying to understand better this entity. I have the pleasure and the privilege of requesting and presenting the Chief Executive Officer to present our report. Suffice to say that I am pleased to be associated with this young team that has been running this institution for a while. And one is very pleased with what has been happening so far. And I'm the co-signatory to the APP and, of course, the strategy corporate plan. But I will request the Chief Executive Officer to present on behalf of the organization.
Thank you so much, Chair. Chair, we have facilitated the presentation, but also the document has been formally presented to the portfolio committee. So what we're presenting here today is just the highlights of what the detailed two reports are actually containing. So that is the table of contents. And then that is still our vision and mission. It has not changed yet. And also what the Act requires of NHDRC is just to refresh your memory, but I'm not going to go through that. Our strategy, sir, is to still maintain that we have to improve our visibility and accessibility, but also at the same time position ourselves as a leader in knowledge creation. And I will talk in terms of what we've been able to do in that relationship, because we believe that it's quite important that NHBRC within this built environment sector has actually a footprint, but also does more in terms of research and development, but we'll speak more about what we're doing there. The third point is to provide our diversified services. You know, everybody knows HBRC as police officers. We're not just police officers. We are here to create capacity in the sector. We're here to grow the sector. But again, we're here to help the department to achieve its mandate. So you'll hear when we talk about our products and services that we provide. Our central objective, of course, is to grow and protect and sustain the warrant funds. This is our money. This money belongs to the housing consumers. We are just holding it on their behalf and make sure that indeed when they make their claims, if there's any structural defects on the homes, we are therefore able to go back and fix those homes. So everybody has this notion that NHBRC is a very rich organization, no world rich, but that money belongs to housing consumers. We are just holding it on their behalf. We have to provide, of course, innovative quality products and services to delight our customers, which in this case are our housing consumers. Of course, we've got to strengthen our NHBRC operating processes and system and procedures. So you know that we've been to this committee where we've made certain commitments, and I'm happy to say that indeed, if you look at our annual reports, we have been able to turn around the organization, and indeed we're now operating at our optimum level. We've been able to fill in a lot of positions, and indeed all operations in NHBRC are now in place. And of course, we've got to create a learning environment and build our capacities and products and services so that we're able to grow the sector as a whole. These are our products and services. This is what we are as NHBRC. So if you ask somebody what you do from 8 until 5 o'clock when you come to NHBRC, we have to make sure that, with regard to the act that established NHBRC, we enroll all new homes in South Africa as a requirement. All home builders have to be registered with us, and they've got to renew their membership on an annual basis. And I want to make this to them, to say, they ask the question, why should I enroll in NHBRC? And I ask them, tell me, why do you drive a car? Every time, every 5 years, go to renew your license as a person. So always at NHBRC, we give you a license to operate. That license, therefore, is your certificate, the builder, to make sure that indeed we still have to test whether your skills are still okay or not to do some work in this section. Home building inspections, sir, also going to talk more. We've invested quite a lot. The last time we were here, we told you our plans. Now I want to tell you exactly where we are now with that inspection processes. Forensic engineering investigations, we're doing a lot, especially in the subsidy center, helping all the provinces and municipalities with their work before they actually enroll their new projects. The assessment of the houses for rectification, the home builder training and development, we've also done a lot. We are changing across the country as we're picking up. We deal with a lot of dispute and resolution between home builders and homeowners. Litigation and legal advisory services. Chair, I will give you a slide here of how many builders to date we've been able to suspend, how many hearings we've conducted across the country, because a lot of builders have said NHBRC is a toothless organization. And we've proved now, Chair, that indeed we're not toothless. We can therefore be able to apply the act, and the number of builders have been suspended. We'll show you the slide of that. And of course, we do geotechnical and material engineering just to make sure that indeed the material that has been used by the builders, it does actually meet the standards, whether it's standards or whether it's our national building regulation standards. These are the committees that the council has established. So from a governance point of view, all is in place. All those committees are up and running. They are actually giving us direction as a management. We report to them, and on a quarterly basis, there's a council meeting. I'm going to skip the objects of council. I don't think I have to bore you with that. Chair, we have looked at our plan, and in this, we are an entity of government, and therefore, all our activities must be aligned to the medium-term strategy framework of government. We've looked at the NDP, we've looked at the manifesto of the ruling party, we've looked at the FONA, we've looked at the minister's budget speech and said, where do we fit in as an NHBRC? And therefore, this document has been submitted to you indeed, response to that. We've looked at the department and the minister's directive of saying, in the next 5 years or four now, if you look at the next financial year, there has to be a delivery of 1.5 million housing opportunities. And we've asked the question, where does NHBRC fit into that? And therefore, this plan that we're presenting here today, indeed, respond to that. Just indeed to make sure that indeed the minister is able to achieve those targets. In this regard, we've been able to strengthen our inspection units. As I'm speaking to you, we have employed 199 inspectors on a full-time basis. These are on the payroll of NHBRC. As you know, previously, this function was outsourced at the NHB, they referred that you can't outsource your core function as an entity. Therefore, all these 199 are deployed across the 9 provinces, and they work full-time for HBRC. We have restructured our business services, which is mainly our core division, where your quality assurance, your technical services, and so forth are actually falling into, just to make sure indeed we are able to expand on our mandate. Our technical division, again, has been augmented. We are now able to make sure that indeed we look at the maximum protection of our stakeholders, but at the same time, we make sure that for the right skills to actually conduct the work under that. But again, we are looking at our technical division and administrative division just to make sure that we are able to respond to our beneficiaries. Our training and development section also has been enhanced. We presented the last time our training and development strategy. I'm happy to say that now we are indeed implementing that strategy. And we have extended an invitation to the committee and also to the minister to visit our training division at the social movement at Eric Mulubi Innovation Hub. That is where our training division is actually based. That's where we conduct our training, not just only for HBRC in our chair. We're expanding that training also to the sector as a whole. That's to make sure that indeed we're able to create that capacity within the sector. We are also going to be establishing what we now call the School of Inspectors and the School of Home Builders, again based at Eric Mulubi. What we're doing here is that we've created a very in-house training tool or program for our inspectors. And we're busy testing it now. And that training model is going to be expanded also to the inspectors of the municipalities, the inspectors also of the provinces, that we have one training component that indeed can be able to provide that training to everybody. And of course, our business management also is our IT. We have been able to implementation of the ERP. We are actually migrating from Oracle to FED. Will then be going live on set by August of this year. We have established a table that looks into the operations of HBRC and also the municipalities and the department. That unit goes out to all the provinces and municipalities that provide the necessary capacity in terms of the project that the provinces are undertaking. We have established, as I said, the Center for Research and Health Innovation. We call it the center. It's also situated at Ekmoropi. That is relevant for research that we conducted. Not alone, of course. We work with a number of stakeholders. I will tell you who our partners are. We have signed a number of MOUs with those centers. And of course, we want to promote housing consumer rights and responsibilities. As you know, that as we go around the country, a lot of people have seen that, especially in the subsidy sector, there seems to be a lack of understanding by our housing consumers what becomes the right of responsibility. About a week ago, I was in the Eastern Cape. You know, a lot of people, when you give them houses, they're not doing maintenance. You know, even just to repair a window, that's to make sure that the house is painted. A lot of people are still waiting for government to come back and actually do maintenance. And we think when you give out those houses, there must be some housing consumer education that should be undertaken. So the minister has given a direction that the center as a whole, of course, led by the department, we must roll out a very detailed and vigorous housing consumer education just to teach our consumers the same. As government gives a house, what are your rights and responsibilities as a housing consumer? And of course, we'll make sure that we enhance our partnership with human services department, the municipalities, and the state stakeholders. So we believe that the village government, we've got the technical capacity, we've got the knowledge, and therefore in that regard we can be able to help our colleagues in those sectors. And of course, we've got to increase our visibility services throughout our customer services. Here, we've got about 22 offices across the country. We operate the 9 provinces, we've got 9 provincial offices, but also we make sure that indeed, out of the 9 provinces, we also have what is called customer care contact center, so that people don't have to travel to those provincial offices, but we must make ourselves available to those areas. We are busy now procuring what is called now mobile offices, and we're busy with the tendering process, whereby the mobile offices will be able to move around. As you know, that Home Affairs does the same thing, so the copies, the same thing that Home Affairs is doing to move around and make us indeed our builders, our housing consumers are able to actually conduct that within a very short space of time. And of course, we'll change our pay offline. We've seen our advert on TV last day, or the newspapers. We want to make sure that indeed we are assuring quality homes. That's all we do as an HR teacher. Chair, this is our ATP in summary. The registration of home builders, we've given you the entire MTF. If you look from 2014 to 2019, and you can see that it's accumulated. The year under review to 2015-2016, you can see that we're targeting 2,500 new home builders that must register. And everybody is asking, where are you going to get these new home builders? Share, as I said, we do a lot of housing consumer education,
You can see now, if you go on our website, if I send you an email today, the signature there, it says, is your home builder registered with NSBR3? You know your home builder. So there's a lot of awareness that we're doing. Just mention that indeed, all those new entrepreneurs who want to join this sector, they must know it's a requirement that they must actually join with NSBR3. Then we've got, of course, the renewals of registration for the home builder to say, if you register with us this year, next year you must maintain and renew your membership. So you can see the numbers are growing throughout the MTF Studios chain. We also targeting our trade division in terms of training the youth, women, and people with disabilities, and of course, our military veterans. So the target of 2000, we do this not only on our own chain. We're working with the MIDC, we're working with the Department of Military Veterans, working also with the private sector, just to make sure that that training is targeted. It's not just training for the sake of training, chain. We target certain fields that are required within the sector as a whole. I've spoken about the training of inspectors. We'll be targeting, we've started this financial year, 400 of those, starting with our own and sending those training to the ones for the municipalities and also the provincial department. We've also worked with the Department of Higher Education in terms of training the artisans. So we have a program that we've designed for artisans, as you can see the numbers there, that we're targeting 351 and they grow out to 400 throughout the MCF. And of course, the enrollment of new homes. You know, Chair, the Act requires that everybody who builds a home, it must be enrolled with NHBRC. And of course, there's a reason why those new homes have to be enrolled. So this one is not substitute, which means your private homes that have been built by private individuals. As you can see, the numbers are growing from 50,000, it grows to 58,000 for the MTF. Late enrollment. Chair, we don't encourage late enrollment, but unfortunately, as people think that, you know, I can get away, you know, and build a home without actually enrolling. We've asked and directed our inspectors here that as and when they go out to inspections, they must increase it. If they see some construction happening, they must go and ask, can I see your certificate as a builder? Can I see your enrollment? If that house is not enrolled, Chair, immediately they issue an non-compliance, they stop the build from actual building. And that means that house must be enrolled as a late enrollment. Of course, there are penalties that are imposing as an HBC to make sure that indeed the house complies. We also looked at the number of inspections that must be conducted. On the number of, as you can see, Chair, number of inspections are going to be conducted almost 200,000 inspections on those 50,205 houses. Remember the number that I've put, that we've got 199 inspectors that are full-time employees of NHBRC, so those are the number of inspections we'll conduct into those homes. On the strategy, which is basically a government program, Chair, the number of inspections to be conducted, you can see the number is up in this one, it's about 385,200. Enrollment of the homes, it's 44,000. Project enrollment is 51,000. Consolidation is 81,000. So if you combine that number, it gives you the delivery number of the number of subsidy homes to be delivered by the sector. And therefore, NHBRC will therefore be enrolling and make that indeed those houses are protected and the home consumers do have a guarantee that indeed if any defect happening for a period of 5 years, we'll go back and fix those houses. Chair, we're just giving you a synopsis of saying for the past 7-8 years or so, what has been the trend in the sector? If you look at the performance of the mortgage houses in terms of the new homes that have been enrolled in HBRC, so you can check from 2008, the graph has been growing, it's steady now, and you can see the numbers indeed have grown. So we're showing you there that indeed the sector is actually now stabilized, but the sector is also growing. You can see from enrollments, late enrollments, and the total. So we're trying to give you those trends so that indeed you can see how did you arrive at our numbers. So somebody asked us to say, if you think we're going to be enrolling 50,205 houses, how do you arrive at that? And I'm showing you that graph there for say, in terms of say, look, if you look at the trends, indeed it says the sector is growing between 5 to 7% on an annual basis, and therefore our numbers indeed are not actually off the target. The registration also for builders, you can see it's been growing. Yes, you can see the economy sometimes is not quite good. The numbers are quite bumpy sometimes. They grow sometimes. They are actually declining. But that is based on our target in terms of the registration, the renewal, and also the total. But the next slide, I'm going to tell you about the active builder that we have. If you look at the renewals, that's the percentage that we're looking into. It's about 26%. Let's go to the next slide. Chair, this is quite important. You know, we are here directly with the municipalities because we want to see the correlation between the enrollment and the plans approved by municipality. And you can see now that if you look at 2009, there was a big gap between the plans approved by municipalities and what are the enrollment that we've had in HBRC. And now we're closing that gap. If you look at 2015, that gap was closed very much. The plans approved is about 53,000. the houses to be delivered 51,000. So at least you can see now that indeed we've closed that gap. And it's, this is what we've been doing. I will be meeting with a number of executive directors for planning at the municipal level, just to make sure that our plans are in order, but also our correlation is in order. Because what we've seen is that a number of builders come to us with unapproved plans. Unfortunately, you can't enroll the houses if your plan has not been approved by a municipality. Therefore, we've worked out the mechanisms on conditions that the municipality will impose on builders, so that we can therefore be able to enroll once they're busy with the process of approving the home building plans. So these are the active builders. You know, if you go on province by province, we'll therefore be able to give you numbers to say in the Eastern Cape, how many active builders do we have? So we're doing this because we want to protect our housing consumers. You know, if you build a private home, you must know, in my area, who is active? What is the tax record? So if you go to our website, there's a function that you click on the builder, you will therefore be able to go by province, you click the name of the company, it will tell you who that company, how active are they. So we've got about 4,000, almost 5,000 or so, active builders. These are the people that on one occasion they enroll about 100 homes to NHBRC. And these are the guys therefore that are indeed active in the sector as a whole. The number of inspections on the non-staff detect, as you can see, the number of inspections that we've been able to conduct on how many homes. So you can see that we've inspected 85,000 homes, how many times? 200,000 inspections that are going to be conducted. On the subsidy part, we are targeting, there was 126,000 inspections that were conducted on the subsidy enrollment and also the subsidy enrollment. Those are the inspections that we've been able to conduct, the 385,200 that I've spoken about. Chair, these are the number of inspectors that we have. I know that if you look at this chair from a face value, somebody's going to say, no, that isn't enough. I've had that question several times, to say, how therefore do you measure that you cross the country with 199 inspectors? If you look at the numbers, it tells you about the projections that we have on province by province already. You can see that your Eastern Cape, your KwaZulu-Natal and Gauteng have got the highest. Precisely because those are where the number of housing actually been constructed. So those are the numbers that we have from our side as an agency that deployed in all the 9 provinces. So let me just spend some time on this slide. It talks to the previous slide. We have made some scientific analysis. We have started to implement models as last year in November. Now we're saying out of the 199 inspectors, if you look at the number of inspections per annum per inspector, we say each of those 199 inspectors, they must conduct 2,408 inspections per annum as an individual. And we're saying per month, that person must do about 109 inspections. Per day, he must do about 10 inspections. Per hour, he must do 2 inspections. So we've been therefore able to monitor them. We've given them gadgets that they will monitor to say, how many kilometers did I cover? Where did I go to? They've got what is called a mobile solution, that's called a PDA. A PDA, if I log to a GIS, it will tell me, this inspector was here, this hour, and this day, did he inspect the house or not? We are trying, therefore, to measure that indeed to put the control in that regard. So this slide is very much important. It talks to the previous slide. But somebody's going to ask, is that the right capacity that we have? Are those numbers right as an HBRC? Will we be able to read out all the houses that we're talking about? So what we are saying, therefore, is that these guys are not office-based, chef. They come to the office only on Monday and only on Friday. Through the week, we don't want to see them. We've not created space for them. We've just done workstations. They come in, they log in, they do their reports, they go on street. So that's how basically we're monitoring them on a day-to-day basis. We're not perfect yet, sir, but we're getting there. Sir, as I said, this agency has made sure that indeed also we deal with the non-compliances, but also we deal with our delinquencies within this sector. I'm just giving you some figures now. It's not yet complete, but just to show you that in 2015, completing of course end of March, we've done a total of 232 disciplinary hearings across the country. We've suspended 193 contractors. And you can see those that were not guilty, the warning that we've issued, fine imposed, those that will be withdrawn their services or their licenses to say, you are not actually going to be able to do any work here or withdrawing your services. So this shows, Chair, that indeed we are now serious about dealing with the non-compliances. But again, we have to make sure that indeed this issue of saying we're choosers of organization is dealt with. The decisions are conducted by independent individuals, not employed by HBRC, but we've got prosecutors that are full-time on the HBRC. We've got investigators that are full-time. We've got our inspectors. So there's a very chain that we've created between our inspectors, our investigators, and also our prosecutors. Our inspectors, they go on site. If they find out that indeed there's non-compliance, they issue a notice. You've got 7 days as a builder to correct what is wrong. If you don't correct, therefore they stop you. Then they escalate that to the investigators. Investigators investigate and give to the prosecutor. The prosecutor will prosecute, and therefore the chairperson of the duty hearing, with independent judge, will evaluate and either verdict it of guilty or not. So this slide and this shows what we've been able to do in the sector. What is the role of our inspectors within the sector? Of course, they conduct our risk-based inspections. They make sure that the quality of standards is maintained. They enforce the compliances. Most important, they make sure that indeed we examine the building chain. It's important before, during, and after construction to make sure that that house provides with the norms and the standards. And of course, we investigate the complaints against structures. As I said, we've trained our inspectors. We've made our own internal training program, and therefore inspectors will be actually be appointed through the program and be mentored by our experience. So, Chair, what is done? We've created categories of inspectors. We don't expect new inspectors, Chair, to go and inspect the house for the 5 million. Now, if you look at, we've got four categories that we've actually put our inspectors. So, we also want them to grow within. So, which means that only our experienced inspectors will actually inspect the houses that are worth of almost 5 million and above. So, but we've measured indeed the mentoring program that we established. In addition, as I said, we will provide that training to other inspectors within the construction industry. But again, we create an internal pool of accredited inspectors. But again, our training program is going to be accredited by SACO. These are the modules of the training program. Just to show you indeed that we want to make sure that indeed the training program is accredited, but also is credible. The qualifications, these are the courses that the inspectors will go towards. And we anticipate that this training program will be accredited by this year, possibly October of this year. Of course, again, the accreditation of the building inspectors, as I just spoken. Chair, you know, there's been a discussion within this sector. You go everywhere in South Africa. There is no formal qualification of a home inspector. You'll go to any university, any technicon, there's no such qualification. All our inspectors is either they're engineers, there are 2S, there are an artisan, and so forth. But there is no formal qualification that can get a TUT, and so forth, and so forth. Now, what we've been able to do in HBRC, we've been doing research through our center, of course, and now we've come to a conclusion that indeed, all our inspectors, they can actually be registered. We're with the construction program management professional, who are busy now with the accreditation process, which means, therefore, that all, if they go to that training will be accredited through the construction program management professional, and therefore they'll have a formal qualification now that is recognized in South Africa. We've got a technical support, as I said, which is all the national, the nine provinces, which is assisting our provinces and also our municipalities with a number of services. I'm not going to go through that, but it's our outline. Can skip that one. Yes. Chair, as I said, we've established a center for research and innovation. What it does, the center, is research and development. We're also busy with the promotion of our innovation building technology and alternative building technologies. And you know, Chair, that the minister has got a target of building 1.5 million housing opportunities. What we are saying is that those houses cannot be built only on brick and mortar. We therefore have to make sure that we investigate and make sure that all those other products that are operating within the sector are actual credited. And in this regard, we're working very closely with ARIMA SA, which is the only authority in South Africa that can actually authorize any other product other than brick and mortar to actually operate in South Africa. So we do now have a plan and a guidelines that are going to be approved by the next minute or so. So the minister has asked us to do some work as an HRC in this regard. And of course, we conduct testing of materials. We conduct research and innovation, geotechnical information systems, agricultural services. So these are all the services that we're doing at the center, as I've said, is based at Eric Mulubi in Social Movement. These are the measures of the center. I'm not going to go through that. The KPIs, that's the way I was. The center chair, these are the top leaders of the center. We do transformation leadership training. We do technical evidence through our research and development. We make sure that we deal with standards from intellectual leadership. And of course, we have to build the entire home building industry. These are the innovation building systems that we've spoken about from a research and development point of view, especially on the energy efficiency star rating system. Chair, we don't have currently in South Africa the energy star rating system. What we want to do, therefore, is to say between ourselves, CSIR and other departments, the environmental department, we now have what is going to be called an energy efficiency star rating. As you know, that as we encourage people to build the houses, we can't always actually rely on the ESCOM grid. There has to be, therefore, that process of making sure that our houses do actually perform to the energy efficiency. And of course, we promote our innovative building technologies through research and partnership with other people. So we're looking at also at innovation and sanitation technology. And you know that if you go to a rural area, you can't therefore rely on your normal water and sanitation that comes from the infrastructure. We are therefore working with CSIR to look at all these innovation technologies that can be introduced through our water and sanitation program. And we do, of course, materials research and engineering in terms of making sure that all the materials that have been used do conform to the standards. You can skip this one. Oh, sorry, that's okay. Chair, we've also reviewed our home building manual, and I'm sure you have seen in the newspapers, in our website, that it is, the home building manual has been reviewed in the guide. So we'll be launching this manual probably in May, June or so. Those are the knowledge management. I'm going to go through that. This is our training, Chair, in terms of what we do, our core pillar. We look at home builder training, home builder development training, those that are already in the sector. In terms of what skills do they require to further their knowledge, we also provide our technical support to our inspectors and also to our technical division, and of course our artisan development program. And these are the training courses that we provide at NHBRC. Of course, these are targeted because we can't just train for the sake of training, but we look at what are the remedial work that we're doing in certain areas. A lot of things in areas about bricklaying, the plumber, carpenters, painter, and so forth. And then our home product development program, these are the people that are already in the sector. We look at business development, the compliance, the technical support that must be provided to them. These are the special research projects that will be undertaking going forward. And I've said the star rating system for energy efficiency of our homes, but also make sure that we conceptualize, develop and manage integrated sustainable human settlement for the usage of our innovative building technologies, the research on sanitation technologies, but also innovative building technology as built, but also make that continuously so we develop the technical requirements for rational designs when we look at our cities. These are our partners that we work with, we work alone, Chair. We have signed a number of MOUs with those organizations, your SABS, your Geoscience Council, your Green Building Council, the Swiss agents, you can name them, but that will say that indeed, as we do this work around the sector as a whole, we are not alone, but we have a number of partners. We've got a women empowerment program, Chair, that we briefed you about last year, and we've got about 100 women that are going through the program. Already 20 of those have graduated from GIFS. They are now going through a mentorship program. We are working with a number of organizations where now mentorship is happening. Most of those women are now getting tenders through government, especially from the provincial department. One of those 20 women has just got a tender worth 30 million from Northwest. So it is now the development of the program. But we're looking at more of those getting some work. 8 of those currently are based on training program at GIFS. We hope that by May, June, they'll be able to graduate, and after that, they'll go through a mentorship program. And I'm sure some of you read City Press. You have seen that every Sunday we're profiling those women contractors through that. Chair, the next slide, I'm just going to give the CFO just about 10 minutes to take you through the budget of how we've been able to put what I was saying in terms of now the rent and sales of an HBC. CFO?
Good morning, Chair, and members of the committee and colleagues. Just to start in terms of the operating context in which we deliver the craft of the budget, the organization is currently in an execution mode in terms of many strategic initiatives. And what we see in the 2014-16 financial year is the full cost of those strategic initiatives coming through. Some of these include SAP implementation, the communication program, marketing, the inspectorate, and then the Center for Innovation and Research. So maybe just to highlight or outline the guiding principles in establishing the budget and what the budget seeks to achieve. In crafting the budget, we sought to try and establish an alignment between the strategic plan and the financial plan of the organization in a way that the financial resources enable the achievement of the strategic objectives. While doing that, we also tried to achieve the secure the financial viability of the organization by ensuring appropriate risk management in the cost structure and balancing of the organization. So typically our commitment to cost needs to be appropriate the categorize between fixed and variable costs, as well as then to ensure that we've got a sustainable balance sheet into the long term to ensure the solvency of the organization. The budget aims to reduce warranty fund losses and to ensure the sustainability of the warranty fund over the period. Then we started to look at the warranty fund assets and related investment activities, and to then contain those activities and profits out of those activities to fund liabilities and economic capital requirements, essentially. In doing so, we then had to apply a constraint on operating costs and then to contain operating costs purely to revenue generated for the period, and therefore aspire to ensure that at all times we, at the very least, achieve a break-even position of operating activities, and therefore do not seek to secure funding from warranty fund. And then finally, to embed culture of accountability, efficiency, value, and innovation, so that we could take the organization and ensure the sustainability of the organization into the future. Our assumptions are basically using CPI 5.5 and then providing for cost containment measures into the budget as the Treasury regulations. Now, once we formulate and apply the principles and take the assumptions into account, you will see our revenue for 2015-16 will be 813 million, which is estimated to be 4% growth. That comes largely out of enrollment fees on the non-subsidy sector, which is 452 million, and then the second biggest contributor will be the enrollment subsidy revenue, which is 276 million. We then have other revenue, which is typically technical revenue for forensic work, and other supplementary revenue streams that we have in the organization, which amounts to 72 million. From there, we will find a total cost base of 787 million, which essentially is driven by the staff costs of 450 million, and then some other IT costs, marketing costs, as highlighted in the strategic initiatives slides. That allows us to have a profit a cash profit of 25 million, after which we apply the amortization and depreciation charges, which allows us to break even at around 128,000. Over and above that, we've got our investment fund, which will generate about 175 million after we pay management fees to the investment professionals. We would have about a 265 million profit for the period. Going forward, if you look at the revenue line, we estimate revenue will grow at around 4%, and a key indicator or trend in that environment is that non-subsidy income starts to stabilize over the 5-year period, but we anticipate growth in the subsidy enrollment sector, which will complement our revenues in that period. For cost base, our aspiration is to contain the cost base going forward at around 7% and then stabilizing at around 6%, which is about CPI plus 1 over the period. So this is essentially the breakdown of the 2015-16 quarterly budget into the different quarters and how we plan to spend it and phase the expenditure. And essentially, the revenue slide, if you look at the blue bar on the graph, it essentially tells us that our major contributor of revenue comes from the non-subsidy sector. But you can see over the 5-year period, the blue bars tend to stabilize and become a smaller portion of the total, while the red portion is the growing part. And the red portion represents the subsidy enrollment fees that will come over the 5-year period, which we anticipate the growth in the revenue of subsidy enrollment categories going forward. Our employee benefit cost of 2015-16 is around 451 million, and that will fund the total complement of staff, which is approved at 714 employees. These are just some of the cost trends over the period, essentially given that we've now repositioned the organization and reestablished its capacity and processes to deliver on its mandate, and this will now stabilize the cost base going forward into the 2015 and beyond over the 5-year period. Our capital expenditure budget is 390 million, off that step is about 91 million, and then we've got construction of new buildings, which is about 67 million, are the major contributors. So the program administration program budgets are in the pack, so I'm not going to go through that in detail. And then finally, this talk about the balance sheet. Essentially, our balance sheet is aimed to create assets of 5.7 billion at the end of 2015-16, and ensures a solvency and financial sustainable position in 2015-16, and that position just consolidates itself over the 5-year period to 2020, which strengthens the financial sustainability and manages the solvency of the organization into the future, which is confirmed in the cash flow statement over the 5-year period.
Chair, in conclusion? Chair, in conclusion, we say that we are see, indeed, during this time, we'll be focused on executing our mandate. As you can see, the correlation between our strategy and our budget, but also how we've deployed our staff in terms of making sure that indeed we deliver and support the minister's goal of delivering the 1.5 million house opportunities. But also, the NHBRC will ensure that all homes built in South Africa are enrolled with the NHBRC to make sure that they are covered within the warranty fund, but also ensure that indeed all the builders deliver quality products. Of course, there will be those that will take chances, but we're saying as long as we are there with our inspectors, with our engineers, we will strive to ensure that we achieve that. But also, Chair, we'll make sure that we continue to capacitate ourselves. You've seen the growth in terms of our staffing. That was spending now at about 660 or so. We want to grow up through the MTF to about 707 plus employees. But we're not just looking at the employees. We're looking at the critical skills that are required by NHBRC. And unfortunately, we have a challenge because we are competing with the markets out there. We're competing with your bigger construction companies because the skills that we require are quite expensive to find in the market. But again, we are competing with your marine rovers, with your group fives, and so forth and so on. Chair, we've got to improve on our turnaround times. We're very strict on our turnaround times. As people come in to actually do enrollments, we know exactly what our turnaround times. If it's 5 days, it has to be 5 days, Chair. If it's more than that, there must be a reason why we can therefore issue that certificate within those turnaround times. Chair, the most important is to improve our planning and coordination with our provincial departments of human settlements, our local authorities, to ensure that all the projects that are taking are enrolled within HBRC. And in this regard, Chair, we have deployed now engineers who are full-time employees and paid for by NHBRC that deployed to the provincial departments of human settlements. They are there on a full-time basis. All we want from those departments is to give them an office. But we give them the laptop, the phone, and everything, and they work with NHBRC. The idea is to make sure that that engineer is able to advise the department from the concept of starting the project until it goes for enrollment. Just to make sure that indeed departments don't go out and do projects that we know that will not actually be enrolled by HBRC. And of course, make sure that we do our housing, protecting our housing consumers, but also regulate the built environment as a whole, Chair. And thank you very much, Chair, for your attention.
Thank you very much, NHBRC, for that presentation. Comments, questions, clarities? Honorable Khurai, you're going to start, followed by Honorable Victoria, followed by Honorable Ghana, followed by Honorable Papa, followed by Honorable Bada, in that order.
Thank you very much, and thanks for the presentation. Good presentation. But first and foremost, let me just my concern is on the presentation. It does not have the numbers. Sometimes it's difficult to go back to the page because I wanted also to talk about one thing. I don't know how can I, because it does not have a number. But I'm sure that that page, the heading is number of inspectors per province. But look at that, the regions. I also look at that my interest one, the state. Female home inspector is 5, home inspector 10, contract is 0. I'm sure even in Northwest and Northern Cape. Can you just explain these zeros? I really love to know what is happening in my province. 2, do you have any program on the home builders that are not registered? Do you have any program? Especially in the rural areas. I'm from the rural areas, and I know for a fact there are many people like pass on the street, there's someone who can come and build my toilet. Stop it there and build the toilet. There's no need to want to happen except in. And even in these RDG houses, I saw the people from the Soto, and remember, I'm not the builders in some of the RDG houses. This is very worrying. On this registration issues. And to tell us on the penalty on unregistered builders. What's the penalty? Is it the penalty that's going to make this person not to even to lift to and build those houses? Chair, in the past I know for the fact when you build an RDP house at the end of the day, the owner of the house sign what you call the happy letter. And if you go to different areas, especially in the rural areas, most of the RDP houses have been built and the owners, they have just signed the happy letter. We signed the happy letter. It's your education program also going to cover that aspect of disability house, because it also plays a role. You see, the house has been built in 3 months. You see, the window is not open properly, the doors and other things. And when you have the privilege, you know, the contract came for another letter that I must send it because room phone to the head office, and room phone in the business as well. And when you find it, the happy letter. And it's happened in many rural areas. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Honorable Sir, when you do your pieces of questions, you remember you still have 3 more presentations that are coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. First of all, we must commend the presentation from the NSPLC. But my Chairperson, what I want to find out is they are talking about the ratification. What I want to find out, the assessment of ratification, how many have they assessed? And the other one, Chairperson, is that one of the system. Do they have a system to help the municipalities to implement their mandate? Because if they don't have capacity in the municipality. And the other one, Chairperson, is that one of contract under number of inspectors per province. It shows that the contract is 058, 0 Limpopo, 0 Northwest, and 0 Northern Cape. The reason of that one. And they are talking about empowerment of 100 women, but only 20 copies. What about the 8? What happened to do? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Miani and your team for the presentation as well. Just some few questions. The alignment of NHBRC, you mentioned that you always align with what the objectives of the department are, and also in terms of the zone and everything, which is right. But I think perhaps if you can be more specific, because the minister is talking about 1.5 million housing opportunities, and more than half of that goes to the upgrade of informal segment. I would like to understand your involvement in that area. And also I'm concerned as Chairperson that the CC always mentioned that in other provinces, the housing consumer education is an issue. And perhaps as a department, we have to make it compulsory, because my belief is that there's supposed to be a department in each and every municipality or province to make sure that before the person gets into the house, that person is educated on what his or her expectation and responsibilities are. And then, Mr. Nyan, in terms of the registration of home builders, you mentioned earlier on that your department did not reach, and perhaps you forgot that you once told us that, you know, your department is kind of well off. You're not depending on any department for anything, you know. And I can believe that he is right. They are rich. Because looking at the figures here, number of enrollment, and Mr. Miani, I want to tell you that enrollment is very expensive. Yes, I can tell from a personal point of view, but I had to pop out more than 25,000 to enroll my house to NHRC. And you can imagine those contractors who don't have money. linking to what Honorable Kurai was saying, do we have the program to assist other contractors? Because for me, it's not about the figures. The way the figures are increasing because people want to build, people want to renew their homes and everything. But you are not clear in terms of how do you assist, whether it's got a subsidy thing, like you've got this rich department, and perhaps maybe the department can also assist you. How do you help the people who do not qualify for subsidies to make sure that when they enroll in your assist, they are getting a reasonable amount? And then lastly, in terms of the dispute and suspension of contractors, I just think that before you decide to suspend, because remember these people, these are SMEs, we're talking about people trying to boost their businesses. I just hope that at least you have, explored all the avenues before you come to the stage of suspension. Because for me, what is important is how to assist them to make sure that they comply. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Kata. Honorable Kana, you have to pardon me. I was just trying to break the May dominance of the speaker. So you can come in now.
Thanks, Chair. And I apologize for not having a lot of questions today, because I thought I'm doing EAP first and NHR PRC tomorrow. So I'm not sure whether it's a test or strategy, but that's a debate for another day. And just on the point that Honorable Kwala was raising, especially around the rural areas, and you were talking about the targets and like 2 per hour and so forth, and I'm trying to think that kind of a target makes sense in an urban area, you know, where there are a lot of housing developments. But then if you have to do an inspections in like your rural areas, we might find that in a village there's just only one house to be inspected. Unlike here, when you get 100 houses that you can quickly kick off, it's how then you manage that, because the distance becomes affected, especially in the rural provinces. I'm not sure whether these targets are also aligned to where the inspectors are stationed, because I think that's a big of a challenge. And just also still on that note, with regard to the self-built, you know, what I consider the houses that are not being sold, because in rural areas most of the houses they are not built as an investment for them, so they are not built so that a person can sell it. They are just built so that I can have a bigger room to stay in. What then becomes the involvement in there? Because I mean, a lot of big houses that are coming up in main rural areas, and maybe the NHGRC moves in and must us, but as Rajeshin CEO, if the NHGRC must start moving in mask us so that others can ask what that mask is doing in that house, so that they themselves, as part of education, they can know that if they want to build the house, at least there's this inspect rate that can come and check whether the house is built correctly. But I think that's the area that's lacking, especially in rural areas.
Thank you, Honorable Kana. Honorable Papa.
Thank you, Chair. Just quickly, I will first of all come to this one of the inspectors. No, the disciplinary hearings. To take one example of the Western Cape, where you have 57, and then all the other rest, the figures will give you that total of 39, which you have indicated there. But now there is an 18, which apparently nothing has been tried on. How long would they wait before something is done on them? Because they are also in business, that is one. Now, on the inspection, this good work of inspectors, at what stage does it become preventive in a way that the way they work, it makes it not possible for people to continue or other people to start this? And further, would you envisage, or don't you envisage, any possible collusion with some field inspectors, with the engineers of the consultants, that is in this mentality of South Africa, sometimes. Those were the only issues I wanted to. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Papa. Honorable Thomas.
Thanks, Chairperson.
On the plans approved by the municipalities, those ones really are mainly done by private home builders. What about on the government subsidy? Because at the moment the policy doesn't compare the housing, subsidy houses to be approved, the plans, individual plans to be approved by the metros and planning division, except if they approve a plan, but not the house, as an individual or a person if they want to attend. So they don't expect those the municipalities. How do you envisage to make a partnership with the metros in relation to that? The second one is that other metros, they have a full a section of housing consumer education. The issue is to, for us, is to deal with the mindset of our people, to take responsibility. Not that they don't know. Oh yes, I know a metro that has been conducting that for many, many years, for over 15 years, but people just not to take responsibility of the maintenance of their houses. The other one, the last one, are the inspectors, senior inspectors that are allocated, assigned to provinces. I see 10, if I'm not mistaken, in Limpopo. And which category of houses that are they inspected in Limpopo if there are 10? Because with the government subsidy houses, they are not building many really.
Thank you very much. Honorable Memes?
Thank you. I thought I was not coming. 2 points. Now that you have called my name, 2 points. I'm covered by others. 2 points. Indeed. NHPRC, your presentation is quite good. You're touching on key areas that we want, that South Africa wants. Whether it's training, whether it's development of women, on key areas. So, always encourage when you are presenting. So, the last point. In many provinces, we still see houses that are standing unfinished. Others are almost finished. So is there any role that you can do, or what happened there? Were you there or you were not there initially? Because there are happening, whether hostels, I thought Stoller would say, hostels or subsidies, is there anything that you can do? Because it's worrying us, it's embarrassing us. If there's anything that you can do there. I hope when you suspend contractors, you suspend contractors such as those who leave 1,000 houses uncompleted. Not punish small ones, and you leave these big ones who are embarrassing us. Thanks.
Thank you very much, honorable members. As I'm handing over to the HBRC to respond, maybe two plantings. One, I see you put yourself target of 2,000 in terms of training for youth, women, people with disabilities, and military veterans. Maybe you can just comment that have you achieved that in the past financial year? But at least we can be able to be encouraged more, just like Honorable Memes. And but there's one area that I couldn't understand. When you were presenting, you said the experienced inspectors, You are allocating them on high property market, and the inexperienced one, you are allocating them on the lower market. Maybe let's clarify that, because our understanding is that the emerging contractors will find the main on the emerging on the lower market. You won't find them on the higher market. So it means most of them people are doing things wrong. You will find them on the lower. So why would you put this experienced one, where the chances of finding faults are rare, and put the inexperienced one where our people are there? Maybe I didn't hear right. Maybe clarify that as you respond. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I will also ask my chairman and colleagues also to assist me where possible. Can I clarify? I'm just going to speak as a slide, but I think that's where the most of the interest is. Okay. Here, members, you know, when we did this in-house modeling of our inspection unit, when I joined NHBRC, unfortunately, there were staff members that were on contract, which means they were here for a certain period. And for us, therefore, to absorb them into the complement of NHBRC now, we've got to follow certain processes. So if you look at those 19, it means they still have a contract with NHBRC, they're not full-time. Therefore, there is the process now of absorbing them. Of course, I must follow what our policy says, otherwise I'm going to be trouble with the union if I don't follow that process. So they are still an employee of NHBRC, they are full-time with NHBRC, it's just more internal on administrative processes. So where you see a zero, it doesn't mean therefore that we don't care. It means they were there before, but they have been absorbed formally into NHBRC employment. So if it's zero, that means on that 114, we'll send them there now. So that 19, when I come back the next year or in a quarter time, you won't see that column. It will be out. But all of them would not be absorbed on a full-time basis. We said they're not going to lose their jobs, but all we want to do is to follow due processes to absorb them. All experience, they've been here for the past 3 years or so. But it's just by must follow the policies to the data. So that's basically the explanation. Now let me come to the senior home inspector and the normal home inspector. Your senior home inspector is people that have been with NHBRC for quite a number of years. They are well-qualified engineers. They are registered with the EFSA. Some of them are QS, registered with the various associations. Now what we've done, Chair, for them to be responsible and reckless, we've taken that 66 and said, you and 66 are going to mentor the 114. Which means as they do the work, they must report to the CCC for them to oversee their work. In that way, we are growing them. Because remember, we've just taken some of them as artisans. Remember, when on a recruitment drive, when we actually advertised for this post, we did not just go and handpick them. We did advertise the newspapers. There were a lot of interest across the provinces. So those 114 chairs, there has to be a gradual process of them also being what is called now your senior home inspector. Now, what it means, Chair, not taking the subsidy sector lightly, but what we're saying is that it's a risk. If I'm going to take the ordinary home inspector who just joined NHBRC in November and expect him to go and inspect a house with 5 million, we can't do that. Because it's a risk for us. Again, I say, if you look at your social housing projects, those projects are quite complex. You've got a slab there, you've got stairs, you've got a plumbing that is quite complex. That will need somebody who's got experience in that regard. But nonetheless, Chair, we've got a training and development program for them to actually grow and gradually also become senior inspectors. And also what we want to do, we want to do a competition amongst themselves. That somebody must say, I have a program, an individual development plan. Let's say, I've joined as a junior inspector, but after 3 years, I want to be a senior inspector. And this is what I'm going to be doing. Remember the training programs that I've presented here for all our inspectors. So, Chair, that's what basically we mean. We want to make sure that indeed, out of our own variables of the office, we know how and where to deploy our inspectors according to the total value of the house that we're talking about. So that's basically what we mean around our inspectors. And again, remember that if you look at our employment strategy of inspectors, it differs. Rural areas is different from urban areas. We have taken into account the transit time between if you move, I'm going to make an example, sorry about Tofa and Eastern Cape. If you look at those areas, it takes you a day to move around. And the issue is to say, how many houses are going to be inspecting? That is why we've urged the department, the municipalities, to say, let's share what is called now a construction schedule, Chair. I must know that in this project, the contractor by this time, where are they going to be in terms of the construction schedule? So that I don't deploy an inspector to go and inspect that one house. When they go to the area, they must know, indeed, I'm going to do so many houses because of what the schedule says. Of that. Otherwise, it's not going to be classified as unplanning or proper, no proper planning. But again, it can be classified as irregular because or wasteful. Because you can imagine driving 100 kilometers to inspect one house. Of course, it has to be done. But we've asked our developers, our contractors, and also municipalities, let's work together so that indeed we make sure to deploy this inspector. There's many houses that are going to be inspected in those areas. So indeed, our deployment strategy differs. Gauteng, Western Cape, your KZN, your Mpumalanga, especially in your urban areas around there, it differs from those that are in the rural areas. In terms of the home builders that are registered in the rural areas, indeed we have a target that we have strategy to actually bring them back into registering. And of course,
if the register has benefits, there's incentives. Chair, if you look at our budget, you will spend a line item. If you look, it also goes to the annual performance plan on the budget. Chair, on an annual basis, we are going to be spending 26 million. That's on training. That training is compulsory for us at HBRC. If you come and register, remember, that's 750 that we're charging you. It also includes training that we must provide you. It includes marketing that we must provide on your behalf. Yes. It includes marketing. So, next time I'll give the incentives that we're building are also putting together the HBRC to say, what are the benefits as a builder for you to actually register the HBRC? Besides that, we're required by law to register. But there are incentives that we're busy working on. But training is one of them. Compulsory, so we have to. Those bills at the next level. That's why we've set the budget up about 26 million, and that we've got to do. And of course, some would say 750 is a lot to actually enroll, but we believe it's still reasonable. It has never been raised for the past, since 1998. It's been that figure. We've never raised it. So I think it's still reasonable, quite enough in terms of the figures that we're charging, but what are the benefits that will come with that. In terms of penalties for unregistered builders, of course, there have to be penalties. And Chair, unfortunately here, we are hamstrung by the Act that establishes an HBRC. The maximum that we can get is 25,000. Maximum, yes. It's 25,000. We can't do otherwise. That is why there's the process of actually amending or repealing the Act of HBRC. You can imagine, I'll make one example. One big developer in KZN was doing about 85 social housing units. It was found built by our DC. You know how much was charged? 1.5 million. So you can imagine what is that to him. It's a change. But what we are proposing is that indeed, they must fill the pinch check. If you do wrong things, you must know it's going to hit you in your pocket. So now, the new proposal that we have is that you must look at the value of the house and impose fine based on the value of the house. It can't just be a maximum of 25,000. Otherwise, they will continue to do wrong things, knowing very well that indeed they will be able to pay that fine without actually any debt to their bank balance. We are working on the EPI letter. The minister has instructed that members look at the EPI letter, you look at the tax deed, you look at what the warranty certificate of NHBRC. So the minister has asked that we put together a program with the sector. And between us, NHBRC, and EAB, and the department, we are working on that program now. That is going to be rolled out, and it's going to be spearheaded by the minister. So that if we hand over houses, there has to be that consumer education to say, what does this document mean? Don't just sign an EPI letter for what the developer asked you to sign. Do you know exactly what you are signing? Have you inspected the house as a home builder? But again, what are your rights and responsibilities? But again, what does it mean for the next 3 months? Whereby you identify any defects, you must identify that. So indeed, it is that program that we are rolling out with the Department on House Consumer Education. And of course, Mr. Changana will tell you, there is a budget for the department. All provinces and municipalities, in terms of the subsidy allocation, there is a portion that must go to housing consumer education. Well, it's irresponsible of government giving houses to people and you don't tell them the rights and the responsibilities. Not just only about the maintenance, but also payment of services. That indeed, even if you belong to the Indian Register, if you exceed your services, something must be paid towards government. So those are the things I want to make sure that indeed people are aware about. Chair, I want to be correct on this one. Member Stone, I'm not going to answer you on assessment. You have asked a question. And we are busy responding to that question. So for me not to give you wrong information in this platform, I'm not going to respond to that question. But we have asked a question to the minister around assessment, and we are busy the department responding to that question. So we'll respond formally to you. I don't want to give you stats now, and then because the minister gave me the stats, minister gave me another stats. No, I want to make sure that we're correct in that regard. So if you pardon me that way, Chairperson, I'm not going to respond to that question of assessment. Because Member Stone has asked a question through the parliamentary processes, and we are responding to that question with the department.
I hear your response, but that response must also come to the committee because now the question has been asked in the committee. So the committee will also would like to have its response.
Definitely, sir.
Yes.
Okay. In terms of our women empowerment program, if you go to that slide, you will see that we started with 20 women. Then the minister asked us, the NHS said 20 is not enough. Can make hundreds. Then we added another 80. By the time the minister asked us to increase the number, already that 20 were already undergoing the training program. They have now graduated. They are now busy with mentorship. So the 80 is currently doing their courses at Peace, as I'm talking to. They'll be finishing the formal part between May and June. After that, they'll do the mentorship. So if they started with the 20, we've increased now to 100. So the 80 are currently undergoing the training program at Peace. The alignment to informal settlement indeed, members, if you look at how they go to the enrollment, the VPs, if you go there, indeed, we've aligned our pledge.
Honorable Mr. and Honorable Kabasha, you are really stepping up.
No, that's
missing our remark. Continue. The Honorable Lemel was asking Honorable Ganga to swap out.
Members, if you look at the alignment with the formal settlement, if you look at the field of consolidation and project enrollment, that actually talks to the subsidy part that the minister is talking about. So what we're saying is that if you look at project enrollment, we must make sure that all those informal settlement projects must actually be enrolled with the HBRC. If you look at consolidation, that way also the body is doing consolidation, which means it's an in-situ upgrade. In-situ upgrade, it means that's where the work is happening in the informal settlement. So our alignment, therefore, of our plans, indeed, they do talk to what the minister actually wants to actually achieve. Members, it includes the informal settlement. Members, the enrollment fee, no, it's not that much. You know, it's about 1.5% of the total value of the house. 1.5%. It's not 10%. It's not 5%. 1.5. So you can calculate. If you build a house, if you build a house worth 5 million, we'll just charge you 1.5 million.
In other words, she's wanting to tell us how much that house
is worth. Yes, yeah. Thank you very much. We just had the 1.5% of the total bill, and we're protecting it. Well, it's an insurance that we pay. Remember, when you buy a car, you insure your car, not so? You don't know what's going to happen. So you need to insure your house also. That's why we say we'll insure your house for the next 5 years for any service defect that will come about. If the bill didn't show you the state of how much we're paying on an annual basis for the remedial work, and what actually we are paying towards what Kudmas are actually complaining about the build-up and so forth. But indeed, it's still a very reasonable feature that we are charging compared to other insurance companies if you actually go and insure your house with other people. The dispute in terms of the suspension, indeed, if you look at that figure, the 18 is fines imposed. We've imposed fines on 18 contractors in the Western Cape. Not guilty is 0, 1, 3, and so forth and so forth. But we're trying to give you a spread of what, therefore, the verdict that will give to those. So those 18 is fines imposed. That said, unfortunately, we're restricted. The act says maximum 25,000. Even if I want to charge a big contractor, a big developer, so much, we can't, because we're restricted by the act. That is why we want to take that out going forward to say, you can't put it into an act, otherwise it's taking you backwards.
Aye. You speak through me. You don't do that. What's wrong with you with this 25,000
that what it means, if you are suspended, it means hard to work. Because as when you go to our website, if you ask a builder or a home consumer to say, let's enter into a contract, we've asked them to say, before you sign the contract, go to our website and check if builder X is still active or not. If they go to our website, they're going to check, no, you are suspended. Therefore, I can't enter into a contract with you if you are suspended. As a homeowner, you know, if you go to our website, you click the province, you click the name of the company, you click the status of the company, is it active or non-active? So that information is available. We've now created a simple app on our website so that then you can be able to get that information on your own. So that we're able to see why it is that is registered or not.
You mind it up, CEO, as you and the other representatives are still responding.
Yes. Members, we have this called Owner Builder Program. Never mind, we don't want to encourage it, but it's there. It's for people that want to build for themselves. But there's a risk, of course, that as you build yourself, you must have the checker skills. And the issue is that, of course, that house won't be enrolled with NHBRC. Because we believe that you've got the technical skills, you can build for yourself, but we have seen a lot of problems in that owner builder program. As a result, it's an area that we are quite concerned about, because we've seen many non-compliances, we've seen houses falling apart, because people believe that they've got the skills they can build for themselves, especially in our rural area. So, and that's why we want to really help people with necessary skills, but also oversee the construction part. Remember, NHBRC is there not just only to just enroll, but to oversee and make sure that we protect housing consumers against any
province will experience in this regard. And of course, currently NHRC Act does not allow us to cover any alteration or extensions. It's only the enrollment of new homes. Hence, also in the new Act, whether we repeal or amend, we propose that also alterations and extensions must be covered. A typical example, the house in Meyerton that is offered, worth 5 million, which was not covered by us. And we're not unable to send our inspectors to inspect the quality of work. We can't send our engineers because the house is actually not enrolled with us. House is unfinished. I think we're talking to the department, the Shanghai can talk more to that to say what are we doing now in that regard, because we can therefore be able to our inspectors to see where there's an activity. Because once the project is enrolled with us, we assign inspectors. Once our inspectors don't go to that project, we will know that there's something wrong in that project and we'll identify and give the department information to say, here we're not moving because of ABC and D, and therefore we're actually coordinating our activities with the department. Chairperson, the training of youth has tend to be corrected. If I look into our quarterly report, the third quarter, we have already done over 1,600 as of end of December. So we should be doing that target of 2,000 by end of March this year. So we have increased the capacity. We have increased also the number of accredited service providers that we're using, that are accredited by SPIDA, to actually do that training. So our numbers are not quite off the target. If you look into that, is what the minister has termed the youth brigade. So those numbers, that's where we're actually dealing with the youth brigade. Thank you, Madam. I'm not sure if the chairperson has anything.
Thank you very much. And can I chair the meeting, please? No, can I chair the meeting? As Ralph is preparing to set up, because now it's going to be the next presentation, so you can talk about the metro inspections and the accidents. So we would get ready, so there's no time lapse in between. And maybe comment briefly as they are setting up on the fact that the rectification work you said in the third quarter you have outsourced it. Just talk about that as they are setting up.
Chair, on the metro, you know, what we try to do, members, is that we have tried to coordinate our inspection processes between ourselves as an HRC, the provincial inspector, and the municipal inspector. We have now developed what is called an inspection protocol. That inspection protocol will talk to what is the role of our inspector in NHBRC, what's the role of the municipal inspector, what's the role of the inspector of the province, and therefore how the inspection is going to be carried out, what are the roles and responsibilities that are going to be actually done. So therefore, we don't confuse the builders. We come and give an instruction, the province come and give an instruction, the municipality can give an instruction, so we're therefore trying to coordinate. So I've been crossing and having workshops across all the nine provinces with our municipalities, and the metros in particular, to talk about the inspection protocol that now we're actually implementing. In terms of the plans approved and also the subsidy part, I stand to be corrected, members. I've been an HOD before. I know it's a requirement. Unless we go somewhere and check this thing. It's a requirement that all plans of the subsidy sector must be approved by the municipality. Remember now, they're going to conform even to SENS 1100 standards. If they don't conform to that, they won't be actually approved. Therefore, you can't submit a general plan. You can't. Because each and every area is different from a soil type classification and so forth and so forth. And it's technical. We can check it from our side and come back to the committee. But as far as I can know, that has to be done. Otherwise, there's something wrong that we're doing from a technical point of view that we should not actually be doing. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. No, we are not going to correct it. We are going to go to the next presentation now. At discussion, you can have it bilateral with the CEO. He has explained himself and he has explained what he understands. We are not going to help us now, whether you correct it or not. It's not going to change what the CEO has said. Can we go to the next presentation?
Thank you, Chairperson, and good day to the 11 members of the committee and the colleagues. I'll be making the presentation together with the CFO, Mr. Roscoe. My name is Stefan Fagazi. Can I go back? Okay. That's why I'm trying to correct. That's the outline of our presentation. Our mandate, vision, mission and values has not changed. I will make a further comment on the mandate in the next slide. In terms of legislative mandates, the Constitution actually provides that everyone has the right to have access to adequate housing. In terms of our mandate, that's what we strive to do in terms of assisting people in rural areas to access finance to improve their housing conditions.
You remember the last time I told you I had a gentle giant with a soft voice. So can you try and raise that?
I will try. And in terms of the Housing Act, the Minister may establish and finance special institution for the purpose of housing development and supervise the execution of the mandate. In terms of us, established by government with a mandate to enable people in rural areas to access finance to improve their housing conditions, that's within the Housing Act. Our mandate is to enable low-income earners to access finance to improve the housing conditions in rural areas, and we target people who are currently earning below 15,000 per month. I think the key point to note is that currently there is a process by the minister to approve the implementation of the individual voucher program. So that would be an extension of our mandate in the sense that we will be administering the implementation of subsidy funds, whereas our core mandate up to now entails providing access to loan, to housing loan to the borrower in our target markets, that's lending business. I will make presentation of situational analysis looking at the external environment of our business as well as internal environment. The National Lending Commission, NPC, published a diagnostic overview years ago before publishing the NDP. What was highlighted in that report was the challenge that South Africa is facing, which entails high employment levels, high levels of inequality, as well as poverty. Triple challenges, as we call that. And then in terms of special challenges, which is the legacy of apartheid, it was found that poverty or poor people living in remote rural areas, as well as far away from, in terms of cities now, far away from places of work and economic activity. So those are some of the challenges that we see when we evaluate run the operations of our business, which is mining. We have looked at the census 2011, and then we looked at the number of households who live in rural areas, which is defined in census 2011 by Statistics South Africa as tribal as well as family. And approximately 4.7 million households live in rural areas as defined by Statistics South Africa. And the number of people, not of households, is close to 20 million. So that's about 40% of the SA population. We'll show below that in terms of our annual, in terms of number of loans that we deliver on annual basis, we are only reaching a little less than 1% of those households in rural areas. Because our mandate does not only confine us to rural areas as defined by Statistics South Africa, but it also includes lending in small towns, so broadly defined as non-metropolitan areas, the census numbers are telling us that close to 8.3 million households live in non-metropolitan areas. If you look at the number of loans that deliver annually, they're about 5.5% if you take the number of loans as a percentage of the number of households. So just to indicate penetration of half to this market. If you look at the fact that not everybody in the non-metros will actually qualify for a housing loan, if we have to confine ourselves on people who are earning below our upper income limit, which is 15,000. So we find that we can actually quantify our target market as 60% of 8.3 million households, or 5.2 million, which is 62% of 8.3. This slide actually indicates that in the year 2013-14, Ralph delivered 44,210 loans, and then you look at that number as a percentage of 4.7 million households, we have only reached 1% of
of the households. And again, 1% is an overestimation in the sense that close to 30% of the loans that we deliver annually are accessed by the same households. That's on a repeat basis, which is actually in line with internal housing or progressive building. If you look at the number of loans that we have delivered as well since inception up to the end of December 2014, we have delivered a total of 446,520 loans, which is basically 9%. If you take that number as a percentage of the number of households, is 4.7. So I think the essence of this slide is that as much as we have delivered based on the resources that we have in terms of our mandate, we have not really fully penetrated the market, so we still have a long way to go in that regard. The National Development Plan is a key is an overarching plan that actually forms our business as well. There are two key chapters which are critical for our business in the NDP. The first one is one dealing with integrated and inclusive rural economy. You know that in terms of the NDP, we pledge to actually create 1 million jobs by year 2030, mainly through agricultural value chain, as well as other sectors like mining, tourism, fisheries, and so on. So we believe that as well, we need to actually look at how we could assist people in rural areas in terms of rural development to access finance so that they can improve their housing conditions, because not all of them will actually qualify for the government subsidy. But as we know, not all of them will qualify or access mortgage finance as well. The second chapter, which is basically critical for us because we belong to the human settlements family, is one that deals with transforming human settlements. As we indicated earlier, that about 3% of our population in terms of the census 2011 still reside in rural areas. So we need to actually see how we as well could assist people in rural areas to improve their housing conditions and in the process help create sustainable rural human settlements. Outcome 8 is a key document in terms of the medium-term strategic framework, because this is what our minister will all have signed with the president. So we have to make sure that whatever we do, the laws that we deliver, are actually in line with assisting the minister to achieve their targets in terms of the medium-term strategic framework. So we're going to detail in terms of the sub-outcomes contained in the outcome 8 document. And this table actually does highlight certain specific areas that are indicated in the FDP and where we see ourselves as well playing a key role in terms of assisting in the implementation of the NDP. So some of those areas under NDP are with under rural development, and some are under human settlements. So I will not go through the slide. In terms of outcome 8, sub-outcome adequate housing and improved quality of living environments. Our status in terms of loans that we deliver to the market, we are contributing to the delivery of adequate housing and improved quality of life in rural areas. That's when people actually not just waiting for government, but actually taking, making their own choice to access finance so that they can purchase materials and build their houses as they gradually improve their housing conditions and achieve adequate housing, which is appropriate for their own circumstance. If the voucher program is implemented, it will also enable people in rural areas to acquire adequate housing and in the process improve their living environments. People in common settlements, not all of them will access a subsidy funds, nor will they access mortgage finance. We believe that we are positioned as well to enable people who are ready, like those who have access at the site, to actually get housing finance loan, add to their own savings, and build their own houses. Another key area which is authorized by government is mining towns. We are currently participating in the departments, I mean, processes to see how we can collectively assist people in mining towns to improve their housing conditions. Not only that, but also people who want to improve their housing conditions in labor-sending areas. We as well, we're planning to engage with UDEPA so that we can actually check right now the number of loans that we have delivered in mining towns like Rustenburg and look at their database and actually see how many of those people have access loans to yield in the places of work, but importantly also how many are taking loans and building in the areas where they come from, whether KwaZulu-Natal, Eastern Cape, and so on, so that we can have a baseline and try to monitor going forward what level of our contribution in addressing the issue of housing for the mining workers. In terms of outcome, a functional equitable residential market, we are one of three DFIs who are currently taking part in the consolidation process, a process that we believe will actually enable us to scale up our delivery in the market. We are also participating in the department's efforts to conduct a consumer education program, because we jealously guard the interests of people in the areas who are in target markets. So our participation in the process, we could want to make sure that we actually contribute to enable people in rural areas to get the necessary information that is delivered through this program. We also operate within the context of other policy imperatives. One is SME development. Let me clarify here that when we say SME development, we don't mean that we provide enterprise finance. That's not our mandate, but we mean that when we look at the intermediaries or business partners that we work with, we have to actually support entrepreneurs who want to venture into housing finance, I mean, industry. So if you look at our own history, when we started, there were no intermediaries or housing finance lenders, so we had to help a number of entrepreneurs to establish their business as startup. So some of those companies have grown everybody now have become, I mean, big business. We are also looking at supporting community-based organizations like dog fairs, cooperatives, so that they can access finance and improve their housing conditions or housing conditions of their members. And especially through this intermediary, through this CBO intermediary approach, because we want to reach self and informally employed people, because from our own observation in what we have delivered in the past, very few people who are self-employed and informally employed have access to housing. And the reason for that is because commercial intermediaries tend to be reluctant to lend to them because they don't have regular income, they don't have proof of employment, and so on. In terms of job creation, RALF is a very lean and mean organization. I'll show you in a slide later. But working with our intermediaries, we are able to support jobs at an intermediary level. Our intermediaries currently employ close to 8,000 people. But also there is contribution to jobs at a community level, because many people are taking loans in rural areas, as we all know, actually hire local builders. That's the point that we have spoken about here, because there is a concept of quality, because there is Ulamin who will say I can build, and in the process he builds a poor quality house. But in effect, there are people in rural areas who are informally employed as local builders and getting paid to do the job. We also contribute to local economic development, because as we have indicated, people employ local labor to assist in building of their houses. We also contribute by supporting active building materials supplies industry. Taken together, that minimizes the financial leakage, because money that is earned locally, in most instances, a large portion of it is used locally. We operate in an environment that is highly sensitive to economic conditions. In this country, we have experienced a slow economic growth for quite a long time now, and looking ahead, the situation still looks gloomy. Unemployment levels remain stubbornly high, just above 25%. Exchange rate is volatile, but recently the rate has been weakening. Inflation, which affects disposable income and affordability levels,
right now is within the band, I think just below 4%. But we get worried, because if you look ahead and you look at what the oil funds are doing now, and as well as food prices, so we don't know what the effect of that will be going forward on inflation. The interest rate remains very, very low. We're expecting MPC to make an announcement. Hopefully there will be no change there. But these are some of the economic variables that we are concerned about, because depending how they change, they do affect people in our target market. The microfinance industry itself, people are still highly indebted. As a result, they can't afford to take loans, they get rejected. The lenders themselves have been tightening the screws, you know, and you can't blame them for that, because they want to avoid to be accused of reckless lending if they run further loans to people who are highly indebted. And of course, the idea is not to push people into more debt, but it's to lend responsibly so that people can improve their housing conditions. So I think the challenge is to ensure that we have lenders who lend recklessly, but equally borrowers have to be responsible borrowers and not push themselves into debt. Then internally, if you look at Valve, our funding situation, I think the table summarizes how our funding structure looks like since 2005. So it includes both the grant funding that came from KfW or German government to our government that helped to establish Reserve. Then subsequent to that, we had a loan, access a loan from KfW via GBSA, totaling 139 billion. And then direct transfers from government, which is our shareholder, 130 million or 131 million so far. And then we have retained earnings, which total about 99 million. And you notice that before 2008, we tried to draw back from the losses that we had incurred. So I think it's pleasing that going forward, we have been achieving a surplus. And as you know, we actually asked the National Treasury that we retain this surplus so that we can allow them to grow in the business. And especially because we have not been receiving, I would say, a large amount of money from our shareholder. So it helps us basically to try to make the ends meet in delivering the loans that we have planned. I'll show you a graph later if it indicates the importance of us accessing additional funding, because it has a direct relationship with the number of loans that we deliver. If we want to increase our penetration, certainly we need additional funding. That is the story that Ralph will share. We have tried to access additional funding. We applied for 12 million from government for the MTF 2017-18, and expecting to get 100 million per year for the next 3 years, starting in the next financial year. Unfortunately for us, our application was not fully successful. So we'll only get 50 million, which will flow to us in 2017-18. So which means in the first 2 years of the MTF, basically we'll be struggling. But maybe it's good and bad. I will tell you why. In the sense that if you look at the current market conditions, probably we'll find ourselves sitting with money. But on the other hand, it's better to have money in the pocket and be ready to actually increase your delivery when the market conditions change, before they can change at any time. But it takes time to get money when you apply for it. So, but what we have done over and above that is to apply to KfW, where that Germany is a partner to our government, and that's how we established. We applied for a loan of 20 million. The challenge for us is that we don't have a government guarantee. So what we did, we tried to go back to DBSA and ask DBSA to access this loan for us, like they did in the previous loan. But because of their recent restructuring, they said housing is no longer within their mandate, so they can't assist us. So what we have done, we further engaged with KfW, and KfW showed the interest to actually lend to us. They've done, some risk or due diligence on us, but the worry there that they have as well is they don't know the outcome, whether the decision makers will actually agree to lend to us directly, given our small size. But also they worry that it can come at a much higher cost to us if they lend to us directly, which will be basically counterproductive, because we're targeting low income markets, and we're trying to reduce the ultimate cost of credit that our borrowers face. But what we are also doing currently with the NHSC and International Housing Solutions, we're also looking at that option of accessing that 20 million. If we fail to get directly, or if it's coming to us too expensive, we want to see the working with the NHSC and International Housing Solutions, we can't get it. So that's a process that we are busy with our colleagues at NHSC. But again, as I've indicated, the downside of loan finance is that it went against our strategic choice or decision effort to reduce the interest that we charge to our intermediaries so that they pass over the benefit to the lower end of the market. And if you cast your mind back to that table that we just saw, you will notice that we have received very little, I think about 24% from government if you look at the total data that we have. So I think what will assist us is to have more free money so that when you look at the weighted cost of capital, it's much lower, so that we are able to aggressively reduce the cost of credit that our intermediaries, or our ultimate borrowers, pay. So this is the chart that I was talking about. The green line reflects a total capital since inception, and the red one, I don't know the color, whether it's maroon or red or color blind. But anyway, what you see there is that each time, like if you look at, during this period, there was a mismatch which basically came as a result of the small banking crisis. So that's, at this stage, we're not really expanding. We're actually assisting some of our startup companies to consolidate, and the board had to come up with a strategy to say how do we then actually grow the business going forward. And when that happened, then we began to get funds, and then you'll see that when we, around this period, we accessed, a loan from KfW, and then you see the number going up. We had prior to that, we accessed about 50 million from DBS, which was a sort of bridging loan, and then you see the impact on the numbers. And then you will note again the decline here. This is the impact of recession. But what you will also see is that 2010-11, that's when we began to receive the first direct transfer from government. And then you see that the number of loans that delivered began to pick up. So I think this is the story. So if we don't get additional funding in the next 2 years, as it is obvious, so basically means the number of loans that we deliver within Hoover below 50,000. If you look at the penetration side that I showed, it means we'll still just, deliver less than 50,000 and not really fully penetrating our market. In terms of human resources, RAF is a lean organization, and this is a result of us being set up as a policy finance institution, working with intermediary partners who are mainly privately owned businesses as well as CBOs. So we rely on our intermediaries to deliver on our mandate. And then, be that as it may, we increase gradually staff capacity based on the increase in the business activity. So business activity increase could be indicated by the additional intermediaries that we sign up, which would entail doing more regular reviews, risk reviews, for example, and loan verification phases. Then another key factor is the DeFi consolidation. We are participating in the consolidation process. So as a result, what we are saying in this strategic plan in ATB is half the story, because then the picture will emerge after consolidation. One of the talks we are anticipating is that there will be one incremental housing finance lender within the consolidated, DFI entity. Currently, NHSC has a division that's focusing on incremental housing finance, and we are also doing that. If that is the expectation, so I think it's obvious that we need even more money, to deliver incremental housing finance, and especially if you bear in mind that there is a huge market in urban areas. So we need, therefore, to build staff capacity. And then another factor that NHSC and RALF are currently tax exempt, and NHSC is not. But this is not a big issue, because in the current business case, that point has been raised, so that at least in the process, before a new consolidated DFI is established in terms of legislation, we do not lose, that benefit of tax exemption. Because as you have seen, retained earnings are a key part of our funding. So when we got tax exemption, that was implemented retrospectively to 2004, so we are able to get that money back and use it for our business. In terms of how do we achieve our targets, we achieve our targets using our current existing intermediaries, but also signing new intermediaries who are ready and willing to lend to our target market. But right now we are also deliberately identifying emerging development lenders who are successful so that we can help assist them and to build them into entities that can actually enable us to scale up our delivery. We're also working with alternative business channels like CDOs and also targeting employee organizations like unions to see whether we can work with their SPCs to assist their members to improve their housing conditions. We are also targeting to work with rural employers so they can assist their employees who want to build in rural areas. We have had an interaction with PPC Cement. We have engaged with the mining houses, and currently we are also engaged with the government in terms of their government employee housing scheme to see whether we could be able there. There could be other new strategic initiatives that we need to explore. When we met with the minister in June, she actually encouraged us to see what else can we do as RAF to assist in the creation of sustainable rural human settlements other than just providing housing loans. So we need to conduct a market analysis to look at what is the gap in terms of products that need to be designed and offered to people in rural areas to enhance the sustainable rural human settlements. At this point, Chairperson, I'll give a chance to the CFO to assess it. Thank you.
I hope you've whispered to him that you've taken some of his net.
Okay, this is really our goal as from a Dunn Scorecard perspective, the four perspectives seen there. Our key performance indicators, obviously the main one, the housing loans disbursed over the period of the current period of government. Our contribution to the 2 million housing opportunities is the 234,000 loans that we put there. We're targeting that of those loans, we've raised our target from 8% going to housing, because there's always some sort of leakage that happens. We're targeting now 88%, and we've raised our goal there. But percentage going to households earning more than 15,000 a month, we're also trying to limit that to a maximum of 20%. A key area of focus for us is households earning under 3,500 per month. And then we like to have at least 60% of our loans going into that community, because that is really where people need to be able to improve their housing. Loan verification visits, this is where we send our team out into the field to actually go and make sure that the money is being used for housing. We have a team that goes out with a GPS and a camera and takes pictures of houses, talks, interviews the borrower to make sure that they actually are using them for housing. We're currently visiting every intermediary at least once a year, and we're trying to increase that further. The amount of money we are targeting for disbursements, you can see that it's spelled out there. You'll see the increase that happens in 2017-18, and that extra 50 million comes in from the department. With the number of, you'll have seen we have constant flow of interns through our system. We have training, and also got to train our existing staff to make sure they're developing, which is why we have a good training budget there. Our income statement, this shows our historical and then our budget going forward. You'll see our forecast for 2015 that there's a positive effect from tax. That's as a result of our getting a tax exemption which was backdated, so we'll be getting a nice refund from SARS over the next month or so. We're looking forward to that. If the department doesn't fund us, we'll find someone else to. And then you'll see our profit slowly drift downwards as we go forward, because one of our key goals is to reduce the interest rates paid by end users. And that means we've got to charge lower rates to our intermediaries. The current maximum rate that can be charged in terms of the National Credit Act is 32%. With our discounting system, we've got intermediaries now charging as low as 15%. Our balance sheet, we have a strong balance sheet, which is one of the reasons why KPL is considering lending to us directly. They said it's a bit small for their normal lending criteria, but they're going to make an attempt to lend directly to us because they consider us to be one of their big successes in their development grants that they've given over the years. This is the annual performance plan to show exactly what we're targeting for the for next year. This is 43,000 loans. 88% of those must be on housing. We find people will borrow money, use it for education. We could find one in the field where the guy would ask, just see the house and he was shown a car, where the person had bought a car instead of buying a, improving his house. Happens occasionally. The cost of actually enforcing a 100% would actually be inefficient, which is why we're happy to have some leakage. And then the 20 and 60 as I spoke. Our expenditure before bad debts, you'll see it is going up as we increase our staff levels, as we increase our travelling to verify the thing, and then you'll see our operating service. Discussed those already in the strat part, training. In terms of our risk management, so those are the key areas that we're actually focusing on in our risk. Obviously, each of these has its own issues, so making sure we protect our mandate is quite key in the strategic credit risk. We constantly, every year, do an audit on each of our intermediaries to make sure that they're a good credit risk, and we get monthly accounts from them. Market risk, you saw each time the market dipped, our loans had a problem, so that's one of the issues we have. Liquidity, making sure we match up repayments on our loans to the cash flows we've got. Compliance, obviously a government entity, big issue to make sure we comply with all the regulations. And then the other risk. Reputational risk is one that we're addressing quite carefully. If we don't have that much control over our intermediaries, except we can take the money away from them. So if they do something immoral like over-lending, overcharging, it can affect our reputation. I'm sure this committee would be very upset to find if we were allowing people to do that, which is why we actually do a lot of work making sure that they aren't doing anything wrong. In terms of governance, the board of directors, appointed by the minister, which has three committees, subcommittees, all of which have people who are members of the board. The board itself has one executive director, the CEO. Everybody else is non-executive. The audit and risk committee has no executive directors on it, and the other two have the CEO on them, as well as non-executives. And then the internal audit function, which we outsource because it's cheaper than hiring one internally for an organization our size, that reports to and is appointed by the Audit and Risk Committee.
Just to conclude, Chairperson, that's the last slide, but I think the essence is that we are saying that we will contribute 233,000 housing opportunities by end of the financial year 2018-19. Even with that number, the Chairperson, we believe that we still have a long way to go to actually scale up delivery of housing loans in our target market. And then there will be a key factor that I highlighted above that will have impact in terms of how successful we are. But we are positive, Chairperson, that if we begin to improve to implement one of the voucher program, because those will be subsidy funds that will be given to qualifying beneficiaries in rural areas to purchase materials so that they can erect or building their own houses. We have had engagement with the CEO of HBRC because it's of quality is a concern to see how HBRC could assist us to ensure that people who are engaged in self-help with the government subsidy funds are able to achieve better quality. But it will help in terms of increasing the number of houses that are delivered. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Mr. Fakaz and Mr. Gordon for that presentation from Ralph. Clarity. Question. Or can we pass to the next one?
Honorable Nganga Tsabase, Honorable Baker, Honorable Tapa, Honorable Ghana, Honorable Tole. So you're not sure whether you want to ask or not. Honorable Tole, Honorable Forai, you have your hand up? Okay. In that order. And you must remember we still have two more presentations to go through.
You recall last year that when you said that your allocation has been reduced, you recall what you said this year in terms of the value for money.
Yesterday?
No, last year.
that what Treasury does in terms of allocation funds. Last financial year, we talked about
you being visible in rural areas, and I would like to get more clarity how far you've gone with that. But also we talked about having been able to capture houses that are built outside the loan application province. How far have you gone with that? So that you get a true reflection of your performance indicators. And then the consolidation of DFIs, we have raised it yesterday with the department that the pace is too slow and the delays are affecting your performances and your restructuring. It's reflected in one of your documents. So clearly they've noted that they've they're working on it. The consultation is expanding to have a touch on that, and then it would be irresponsible of me not to correct the answers. Having worked as a lecturer, chairperson for 10 years, involved with the general building plan, it would be really irresponsible of me to say that lecturers are not required to submit general plans for the development of government houses. My statement that I would like to be noted on the handbook is that after the building plans have been submitted to the planning department, development planning department of the metro, the law to exempt the government building houses to be inspected by building inspectors of the department of planning. They are only inspected when the houses are built. They are only inspected by the provincial inspectors.
They are also by
the Department of Human Settlement in the metros and national. They are not. And for us is to advise the human settlement to look at the legislation and amend it so that inspectors of the planning department of the metros are able to monitor the extensions that are done on government subsidy houses so that they don't collapse during the extension by the individual beneficiaries. That's where I was arriving at. Thank you.
Honorable Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, just a very short one. In the department's mandate, I say that the access to housing finance for low-income rural housing households earning less than 15,000. But in your NCSF task report, the table that you've got here, it's showing figures for 15,000 rand or more, and then underneath this you've got 3,500 rand or less. So you have the NCSF targets, not the annual. I think it was the first table in the booklet. Yeah, there you go. If you have a look here, the third column down, percentages of loans to households earning 15,000 or more. So it's either letter administrative error or else you've excluded the 3,000 to 15,000 range. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Baker. Honourable Chapa.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick one. Exactly, Honourable Tabahe has touched on, because I just wanted to ask briefly that where and how your clients in the areas accept and know how to get you to communicate or get you where. And then the last one, second one is just the clarity. I'm just concerned about this statement on your performance environment where you say informal settlement present an opportunity for access to housing loans. My concern is that informal settlements actually is a challenge, but now when you present them as they create an opportunity for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Fana.
Thank you. Quick one on housing. I think I asked this last time, and I'm not sure if I got satisfaction. Which part of housing does Ralph operate in? I think I see the penetration is at 5.8%, and how then we consider to be an element. And then the other side is the 0.104. If you can just have to see that. And then, secondly, the loan verification. I see the money and some targets for that. How do you then choose which loans or the recipients do you point verify and which ones you don't? Because you did mention the issue of, in some instances, that someone has bought a car. And then just in the last one, it's around the intermediaries. Yeah. Have you had an instance where a chosen intermediary has done the business contrary to the agreed, way of operating? In instances, maybe they charge too much, or they are confiscating ID books and SASA card, whatever it is that they are confiscating. Have you had an issue with some intermediaries in the last respect?
Thank you.
Another
question.
Thank you, Chairperson. This entity shows that it deals with the rural areas. It becomes rural. Chair, mine is only one on finding effort to assess additional funds. The press number two, DPA has restricted its mandate to exclude housing. Hence, cannot assist RAF to assess KFW loan. So what I want to find out, what have they tried to negotiate with the PPSA to be included in their mandate? Because sometimes it can help if they can negotiate. Or other departments can help them. Thank you.
Siyabonga, Honorable Speller. I haven't left a vote. Can you respond, Honorable Official?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. On the question of the visibility of rats in rural areas raised by Honorable Ganga Kamase, as well as Mr. Honorable Tap, in terms of what have we done, we are continuously trying to raise the awareness of rats and what we do in rural areas through various mechanisms. One, we do package together with the department the capacity building unit in presenting in various rural municipalities about what RAF does. Over and above that, we also use local media, especially in African languages, to advertise and promote informal housing finance that we facilitate, and targeting the general public, even including the name of the intermediaries that that we work with in delivering loans in various provinces. And then a testimony for that, at RALF, we receive calls from various parts of the country, people inquiring how they could assist and access finance as far as borders in Wombavu. But again, it will never be enough because the product that we deliver, it is unlike fast consumer who, if you like, you know, that are always media, TV, and so on. It's sort of a niche. But also, we also try to be careful that when we do advertise, because what we have noted is that over a long period of time, whatever targets that we have set, we always achieve them. But what we also encourage our intermediaries is that they also promote the housing finance, I mean, product. But I think there will always be a gap, which means that we can't do, I'll say, more than enough. We have to strive, you know, to continuously look at people within our target market who need to assess housing finance to improve their housing conditions. In terms of what have we done to capture houses that are built outside the places of work? This question was raised by Honorable Ngana Kabashe, as well as it also relates to Honorable Ghana in the question that she raised.
I think the key concern that was raised when we were here before was that we're landing in Gauteng, and Gauteng is not a rural province. And our answer to that is that there are certain areas in Gauteng that are rural, like if you go to Hammanskraal, one of our intermediaries is very active in that part of the province. But also, you will acknowledge the fact that Gauteng is an economic hub in this country. So you have many people who work in Gauteng, and in fact, he is in rural areas. If I were to make an example of mining employees, I said earlier that we want to actually engage with DEPA so that we can look at people who have access loans but build in rural areas where they come from. But what we actually try, we're trying to do internally is to encourage our intermediaries to change their application forms, have an application form the place of work and the place of investment. Because the place of investment becomes very important for us when we do verification, because then we can send our team to go to where it is, where the miner is really interested. It's a very cumbersome process, and especially as we're ending doing what it is, but it's something that we need to do so that when we report to Parliament and the Minister, we can put numbers that we are very confident about. Because right now we have loans registered in Gauteng, but if we know that the investment, date of investment, was another province. So we strive, honourable members, to improve the voting in that regard. Honourable Baker, our mandate in terms of upper income limit is up to people earning up to 15,000. So that was a typo, that number, which we need to correct. And we are really, really embarrassed, but thank you very much for pointing that. In terms of less than 3,500, you know, when the upper limit was increased, it has increased, you know, on several occasions. It was 7,500 in 2004, then increased to 9,800 in 2009, and then last year, April, it increased to 15,000. But the message that we have always received from the minister and the portfolio committee that when we increase the upper limit, the temptation should not be there to lend to the upper, you know, the impact. So we still need to make sure that we set that at least 50% of our loans going to people who are earning less than 3,500. Since we also focus in rural areas, the income levels in rural areas are very low, except when we get professionals like teachers, you know, nurses. So we actually made us to apply for the increase of the upper limit so that those professionals are able to access finance and build their house, especially because they have no title to land in rural areas and therefore they can't access mortgage, so they become a key market for us. Informal settlements being an opportunity, Honorable Papa, well, I do concede that this is the challenge that this country is facing. But looking, I would say, from a business perspective, we having a product that we deliver to the market, it becomes a business opportunity to address the challenge. In other words, it's a solution to the challenge that informal settlements are. I will let you, Siso, Siso, to answer the questions raised by Honorable Ghana. Verification, how
we... On the verifications, what we do is we get a list of loans granted by an intermediary, check the number of loans that they've got. We then go to a selection for program to make sure we get a statistically significant selection. We randomly select the borrower. We randomly select 50% above the needed necessary sample, and then we actually phone the borrowers to make sure that we actually reach the correct number that we need for a significant sample to be done, and then go out into the field and meet with them. Normally we find that the reason we go 50% over is because people who change their phone numbers quite often, they become uncontactable. So, and also some people just don't want us to come and have a look. Those ones do concern us, but if somebody says you can't come look at my house, they do have a right to privacy and not much we could do about that. But we're really trying to make sure the intermediaries are doing their job, and that I think we're doing pretty well in finding that we're getting what we're looking for. In terms of intermediary acting outside of the legal requirements, last year we cancelled the facility for one who was lending in Gauteng and really not making any effort to make sure their loans were going out the out of the that they were being used out of the area. We asked them for information on that. They said they'll give it to us, and then they said they'll give it to us, and then they said they'll give it to us. So we said, well, you can give us our money instead, and they repaid us. We did have one community who we found had made a mistake on interest calculations. They are obviously refunding all the interest that they overcharged to the retail borrowers. If it had been deliberate, we would definitely have pulled the loan back from them as well. In terms of negotiating a mandate change with the DBSA, they've just gone through a complete restructuring process. We did ask them if they could do anything. They said that they've just changed. It's an instruction from National Treasury and it's focused on infrastructure. They're mainly lending to municipalities. And we asked if they could make an exception for us. They said as long as they didn't have to take any risk. KfW's view was that the reason they're lending to DBSA is that the DBSA takes the risk. So their view is at the moment, no, they're not prepared to make any changes there. They also aren't prepared to give us a rejection in writing for some reason. They get very embarrassed when we ask for that in writing. But we're not getting any joy there. So we're focusing on direct borrowing.
Thank you very much. That sort of concludes our engagement with us for now. And NHFC, where are you? Who's following? Is it NHFC or... Yeah.
Yes,
are you ready? Are you ready? Is it National Ready or NHFC Ready? Whoever is ready must come. Because we don't want to waste time.
Can
be because anyway you are meant to be one DI. So one person can pick on behalf of all of you. There's tea outside, there's coffee outside, but I'm reluctant to announce that because we are going to be happy. So you can do it quietly, while you are collecting the numbers, you can just grab and then do it quietly. The rural entity is living because they are rural by nature. Any rural entity that when it becomes rural, so they are thank you. Over to you.
Honorable Chairs and the Football Committee members, it's a privilege for the NHFC to present the strategic plan for the next 5 years, 2015 to 2019. Now, I think what is key, Madam Chair, is that just to clarify the main business of the NHFC, because our mandate at the moment focuses on the affordable market, and we know with the consolidation it will be encompassing. But for now, just talking about the current mandate, which says we're broadening and deepening access to affordable housing finance, which actually says that it's not that other parties are not lending in this segment of the market, but it's just that they are not going deeper and they are not even broadening it. They're telling people like Unit, that would be people like teachers in a sense, and some of the government's employees. So to that extent, our job is to make sure that we actually broaden that access and we deepen it. And that's why when we think about the NHFC, in terms of numbers, the Banking Association has actually quantified the number of people. At the moment, it's close to 2.5 to 3 million who are being targeted to be served by a mandate such as ours. And we work together with them as partners to try and achieve that. Now, I think of significance on this part is that we are a credit-rated institution. Therefore, we can go and raise funding, alternative sources of funding than just government. Though our classification at the moment, which will change with the consolidation, is 3A, and 3A, we have to go to National Treasury each time we want to go. And the proposal that's in the consolidation is to actually change that so that they can give us flexibility to be able to do that. I'll just give the internal ones. Madam Chair, I just want to put forward to the portfolio committee that the way one can judge the NHFC's success. It's actually twofold. On one hand, we are looking at the household who earns between 15 or 18 up to 20,000. And we say, I think it's an acknowledgement from government, we're not a retail institution, so we don't have branches, we don't have networks, we don't have ATMs, but the bank has that infrastructure. So part of our thrust, based on mandate, is to ensure that banks actually do lend more and do approve loans that on their own they would have said no to. And doing that, we use various mechanisms to be able to do that. Now, a typical example is the facilitation of this as an example, where someone's affordability level could be lower than what they aspire to acquire. But now, if you put the subsidy like this, then the bank would be able to give a mortgage. So in that case, it's not necessarily, you know, the loans given by NHFC only, but is how successful are we in bringing other partners to lend this segment of the market. For instance, we have employer-based lending partnerships. Now there we encourage employers to make a contribution as well for their own employees. Branding Towns is one example, and we did one with Impala Fair, where 2,000 workers at Impala Fair were financed by NHFC and the mine itself. But what is key is that our role is to facilitate other people to bring in their money, to help the people who are caught up in this segment of the market. So that side of it is directed to the household. And then the larger part of where money goes with NHFC is the building and the construction of housing. And predominantly here, the whole financing of rental housing, I can't say we work together with the SRA, but we've been the sole financier of social housing in terms of top-up financing. And the whole institution, you know, will get to that. But I just wanted to clarify that judgment on how successful we are is not just the number of loans you've given. It's also, in addition to that, how much has been delivered by our parties who, on their own, have not participated, had NHFC not intervened with them. So that's why our trust is both in the demand and the supply side. Madam Chair, just to give a picture of cumulative impact of the NHFC, we've shown the years, dark blue is up to 2014, and then 15 onwards, these are projected ones up to 2019. And we've done the same as well with disbursements. We've disbursed up to now 2014 up to 6 billion, 2015 it will be 7 billion, by 2019 it's close to 9 billion. And then we come to the issue of profit and loss. I'd like to highlight this because it's something that will come back when we have to table our annual results for 2015. As you see, the profitability of NHFC is actually more affected in this current year because of the restructuring that we did. We were a staff complement of 82, now we are a staff complement of 60. So that had to do with people who actually voluntarily wanted to be retained at HFC, but also to make ourselves, I think Sablani said, is main and lean to run the organization. But also, I think as an organization, that is a wholesale, we had to really get back and to say, how best can we deliver with less resources, allocation of resources that we have. But we have, however, given a projection of how we see that profitability actually growing over from 2016 to 2019. Now, Madam Chair, I think what is important is that the NHFC's programs and objectives are aligned to the National Development Plan. Firstly, the development plan actually says under human settlement, we need to be providing housing finance options. And that's exactly what we have done. There's rental, there's private rental, there's social rental. We facilitate home ownership, installment sales, and we also do incremental housing, which is what Fabadu was saying. They do rural and we do urban. And we hope once consolidated it to be one incremental housing and portfolio. And then there's inner city development. I know I've repeated this to the committee that I make the claim that we are the pioneers of inner city financing. Firstly, in Gauteng, but now we've now gone to KZN and we're going to Bloemfontein. And the whole inner city regeneration has been financed mainly by NHFC. Only now, in the last year, that a private sector began to show interest to want to finance that. So for us in the NDP says we should be financing housing where people are living closer to their place of work, where there's transport locations, and therefore the inner city redevelopment is quicker, it's faster, and that's where most of our money has gone to in terms of financing. But also, according to the NDP, governments need to be spending less and leveraging more from the private sector, and that's what we've been successful in doing up to now. I can say, Madam Chair, to now, every rent NHS is put on the ground, plus 4 rents is being put by other partners or private sector. So which actually says the quantum and the impact that results from that is actually greater than the money that we've been giving ourselves. And then critically is the whole issue around radically revising the housing finance regime, which will actually be encapsulated by the imminent DFI consolidation, where human settlements for the first time will be able to provide finance from end to end. And obviously, as Prabhat did mention, this will require recapitalization by National Treasury. But also, the plan we're presenting, Madam Chair, is a revised plan, revised for two reasons. The first part why it has been revised is firstly to align it with the MTSF, which is the Minister's mandate when he came on board. But secondly, the actual allocation given by National Treasury were less than what we had requested. Now, in view of that, the plans that are tabled here, the plans that take cognizance of the fact that whatever we asked for which was not given, we are making do with what we've been given. And so the next 5 years of the NHC, the assumptions there are based on the fact that this is what has been allocated to us, let's make use of that to be able to deliver going forward. I think with that, may I ask the CFO just to speak to the numbers as a result of that.
Thank you, Chair. The following two slides basically just deals with what we have to forego as a result of the reduced capital allocation. And I think maybe to start right at the bottom where we look at the funding assumptions, when we prepared our plan initially, we relied on shareholder support of 1.1. This ultimately did not realize, and eventually it was reduced to the 550. Given that in this year we will not be able to, or the process will still continue to acquire the debt funding, but where we are now, we do not have any approvals to borrow. Hence at this stage, we're not including any debt funding at this point in time. Given that funding structure then, we then quantify what we could have done if we had received the initial amount, both in terms of our developmental impact, which we specified at the top, as well as funding impact, which is the second block indicators. Similarly, as an institution, over and above the developmental targets, we also set financial targets to ensure our sustainability. I think I've noticed that we were capitalized at inception in 1996. We have not had, barring the current financial year, any additional capital allocation from the shareholder. So we relied on our, you know, building our internal reserves to fund our business. So hence the importance of setting financial targets for the business. When we set financial targets over the 5 years, given the reduced capital allocation, it will now take us longer. We have our escrow set deadlines for us, but albeit at a reduced level. I think key to this that will come through is the operational efficiency, where we set a target of 40. And through the restructuring to which the CEO has alluded, we should be able to maintain that. I think the other key number to note is this growth, which basically defines, you know, our growth over the next 5 years. Where we have planned for 14%, it is now an average of 5. But again, as the previous DF also said, this might be a good thing given the current economic environment as well. So just to summarize the impact of the reduced capital allocation, I think there is currently a request, you know, from the shareholder to prioritize social housing, and to the extent that even the capital allocation is linked to that. So it does influence where we apply our capital, so it's almost like we have to sacrifice on some of the other programs, whereas some of the other programs might, you know, facilitate private sector funding more. As demonstrated, there is an overall reduced financial as well as developmental impact, as well as reduced contribution to the MTSF. Where we set targets previously, as we said, it will now take us longer, you know, to reach the sustainability that we aspire to.
you. Then going on to a summary of the strategic plan, I think the economic environment has been highlighted by the other presenters, so I'm not going into that as well. I think from an operational point of view, the capital structure is key to us, and going forward, trying to still see where we can get debt funding to support the equity funding again. Pricing is key, but also acknowledging that there are limitations to the us being a price taker as to, you know, where you can put your pricing. The operational structure we spoke is a significant progress has been made in the current financial year, where this has been completed, and the growth of the loan book we spoke about as well. Going on to the overview of our strategic plan over the 5 years, we see ourselves delivering 47,897 housing opportunities. Number of jobs facilitated to 28,734. We have set a target towards broader BEE. This is, includes women, youth, and previously disadvantaged, of 474. Maybe just to mention, it's usually 20% of our disbursement target for the year. Our disbursement target is set as 2.3 billion. And then this is key for us leverage funds, again the point the CEO raised. In addition to our 2.3, we will be able to leverage an additional 3 million, which will then take our total funding impact to the 5 million. As highlighted previously, the confirmed shareholder support over the period is the 530, of which 230 received in the current financial year, and then 100 in each of the next 3 years. Our strategic plan is aligned to the NTSF targets, the 1.5 billion that the minister has set, and some of the outcomes that we work towards is social rental housing, with a target of 27,000 have been set over the 5 years. We see our contribution being 22% of that. Similarly for private rental housing, where the target has been set for 25,000, we will contribute 62%, sorry, to the target. And then our other programs that we have are in affordable housing, and there is a slide splitting it up just now of 110, we see ourselves contributing 24%. So in total, this is our contribution to the MTSF as stated by the minister. Our programs, the thrust of our programs are twofold. The first one is what we do with our own funds, which we call our disbursement, and the second one we'll see later is through leveraging private sector funding. So again, how we will do that, through our own funding we will do 18,000, and this is just to show over the 5 years how it will turn out. We will put 2.3 billion of disbursements into the market, and basically coming from a pipeline of 2.3. The following slide basically just, it's the same information, just give me a split of how that is made up through our various programs. I think the CEO has mentioned that we provide various financing options to the end user, being social housing, private rental, affordable as well as incremental loans. And this just basically gives a breakdown of those indicators. The second thrust is then through facilitation and through leveraging, which we, up to 1 billion, will leverage an additional 3 billion over the next 5 years, creating an additional 29 million of housing opportunities as indicated. And similarly, the following three slides basically just gives the breakdown through the various options that we present to the end user, how that is made up. As indicated, we've also set on financial side key ratios for sustainability, which is highlighted there. Also including, as mentioned before, our other developmental impact targets, which is an estimated number of jobs created, which is 28,000 over the 5 years, as well as a broader BEE, which is targeted at 474 million over the 5 years. Footprint, leading us then to the financial performance. I think we have highlighted previously that we have we reported at a group level, it may be just to highlight again a group structure. We have a well-owned subsidiary Cape Town Community Housing, cumulatively provided almost 4,119 housing opportunities. Although they've delivered on the developmental side financially, they have been struggling, underperforming
and currently we are busy with a board approved restructuring plan for BTCHD. Housing investment vouchers is one of our initiatives where we put in 33% and a private funder or mutual has put in 67% towards this initiative. Still in incubation stage, they just completed the first trust cumulative delivery, and this is, we've included the audited numbers, so we will improve this year, this is as last year, of 397 housing opportunities. Trust for Urban Housing, this is one of our key partners in the urban inner city rejuvenation, where the CEO has mentioned, where they've predominantly been in Gauteng, they've now moved to Eastern Cape as well as some of the other provinces. Key there also that they've secured additional funding, and through the private rental has contributed 18,000 over since exception to add to that of the National Housing Finance. Some of the key drivers of our performance, I mean, our main income is the lending income, where, as we highlighted earlier, given the growth in our book, it will come through. Moderate interest rate increases are expected. Sale of houses comes through the CDCHC, and we have seen in this year there are a significant growth in some of the sales, given key of the projects being completed. One of the key things that influence potentially this year is an increased level of impairments. Usually the impairments is driven by, we make assumptions of credit loss ratio of 2.5 on the growth of the advances portfolio. However, we have experienced in this financial year some of our key clients involved in mega projects experiencing problems which does influence our profitability for this year, and as well as operating expenses. Whereas we are incurring once-off cost of restructuring in this year, however, the resultant savings reducing coming through from the 2016. Finance costs decreasing over the 5 years on the assumption that there's no further borrowings. This is the income statement that over the 5 years, as we've explained, showing the trend growing from the current year, which is the big trend, after the 5 years of 127,000. 127 million. Balance sheet, again, like I said, in almost forecasting an average of 6% growth over the 5 years, as well as limited or the 530 shareholder support as well is incorporated into the balance sheet. That then translates to our key performance indicators, which we have demonstrated there. And again, what is pleasing, although the cost up until this year, we do see the cost to income ratio high, it's improving to within the target that we've set over 40% over the 5 year period. The next section deals with the first target that we have set. I think it has been reported previously that the recommendation was under review by the department. It is recognized that there are challenges in, you know, the implementation of this. So it is also subject to the resolution of the recommendations that are under review by the department. The target that has been set for first by the MTF is 70,000, and through the plan over the 5 years, it can contribute 21% of that target. In addition to that, there will also be private sector leveraging of an additional 3.8 billion coming through over the 5 years. The capital budget required for PICPIC is 10 million, and then almost an operational cost of on average 5 to 6 million per year, and the assumptions of the allocations over the 5 years totaling 632 million. Just two slides, basically the one dealing with our governance structure. I think NHFC conforms to Kingsley and protocols of corporate governance. We remain a CA, a Schedule C in terms of the PFMA. The board is supported by a number of board subcommittees, as we've demonstrated, and since inception, unqualified audit report. The next slide basically just gives an overview of the risks that we're exposed to, how we're managing those risks in achieving our strategic objectives. And these are just some of the projects that we've been financing. Gauteng, KZN, Cape Town, Tshwane, is London, Nelspruit, Kimberley, Bloemfontein. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. And let us see.
You see, I can see Honorable Rara exhausted. There's still one more to go. Hang on there. Honorable Stone, it feels like you are the only one. I will join you when you finish.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I was trying to check on inner city regionalization because I know that the problem of public works. I'm trying to get out the relationship between them and the public works because the inner city regionalization is very low. The pace of development is very, very low. So now I want to find out their relationship. And then other one interesting is that one of the one that was not by this for. What I want to find out if there is any matter that arise on that one, what are they going to do if there's any need? Because it shows that in 2014 is 714, but there's nothing now. What is going to happen if there's anything that happens?
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Tole. As you are going to respond, NHSC, probably there's two clarities from my side. One, when we had a discussion with the department, a question arose around the program. And we were told that NHFC will answer for itself. The presentation is totally brought back to the department. So probably, now that you are both here, where must this ball go? So that's starting for me. Which court can this ball go? And that's one. Secondly, I'm impressed because your presentation keeps telling us about your challenges in terms of finances, in terms of not raising the money that you would want to raise. Because from the, but at the same time, you have exceeded your target. You're doing well in exceeding your target. How can you probably teach others that in, despite of the financial challenges, you still exceed your target? How do you do it? Maybe share with us. For me, those are the two questions that I would read as your response. Because if you exclude the target, it means you don't need the money that you are applying for.
Thank you, sir. The energy generation that the NHSC is doing is not linked to the public works per se, because I understand that one is run by the city of Johannesburg. The one that where the NHSC has been involved in, we have set up a company called Trust for Urban Housing Finance, and the reason was that there was a lot of interest coming through from the city, inner city regeneration. I think primarily because of the National Treasury had certain incentives whereby people could depreciate those assets quickly, and that created a lot of interest in the inner city. So the NHFC setup was tough, a company called for Urban Housing, and that was mainly to focus on the inner city regeneration. Now what we have done there is we have taken a stake in terms of equity investment, but that was purely to attract capital into the inner city. As you know, the banks and everybody has flown out of the city and have identified it as too risky. Now what NHFC has done, they've managed to attract capital into that program of about 1.8 billion rands, and there's a lot of other institutional investors like the PSC, Future Growth, which is a subsidiary of Old Mutual. And we have had interest coming through from overseas investors, though nothing has happened to date. I can also respond to the one under exceeding the target. So what has happened is we took a strategy about 3 years ago where we realized because of the time that it takes to turn over a project, especially the Green Bush project, we built quite a large pipeline base so that we could then be able to achieve our targets. But the reason we are exceeding is, of course, it's a double-edged sword. What has happened over the past 3 years is some of the clients that the NHLC has started funding have now graduated and are accessing capital from the banks. And now they have settled their facilities that they had with the NHFC. And I'm talking funds in the region of about 300 million. It is not good in the sense that we are losing revenue. But on the other hand, if you look at our mandate to normalize the market, we have achieved our mandate. Because now those lines which the banks couldn't look at before are now operating in that space. Another reason is the local banks are still not interested in funding this market per se, but we are getting good funding from international intermediaries, and we are able to extend this at reasonable rates because we are always in consideration of whatever price our loans out at, it does impact the end user. So that has also assisted us in terms of the funds. I leave the article to my colleague. Thank you.
Now that both of us are here, the department, I think we speak in one voice though, because we're together here. The fact of the matter, Chair, is we have experimented on FET for the past, since 2012, 13, 2014. Now, FET performance, in fact, I must also highlight this to the committee. Private sector is looking for FET. Let alone the households. On one hand, the households are saying, if there is such an instrument of government that is meant to assist us, we'd like to see it being rolled out and in scale. Private sector is saying, FET is one of those interventions which will be a great success because it leverages their ability to lend to people who have not otherwise done that. So the scale at which this is in demand is very high, which actually says our responsiveness as government to that kind of paper needs to be streamlined, structured, and also be given some level of certainty. The current FLIS implementation has got all those challenges, simply because it's done remote to the NHFC in terms of approval, and also is at the discretion by the province. Some provinces will go for it based on the budget they give, and some provinces will not make it a priority. Now, part of our proposal to the department, which we have engaged with the department around this, is let's look at the different mechanisms through which we can bring certainty around this specific different mechanism. And part of that is the FLIS allocation to be done differently than what it is done right now. And that process we have taken through the sectors of the department, that either it is somewhere now where it has gone to been top, maybe the department initially bear witness to it. So it is that revised model that we believe will actually make place what we all expect it to be. It must be scaled up because the demand is great in response to the demand, but there are partners who are willing actually to see place being a solution to our people. I don't know, Bulian, if you want to add.
I concur with the CEO. They made practical proposals on how to structure the program. You will recall that there were legal issues as well that they wanted us to deal with. For instance, the amendment of the preemptive rights laws, where some of the private funders were worried about the preemptive rights laws. If you're making the biggest contribution as a private funder, it means that the bigger part of the risk will be incurred by that particular funder. And the preemptive right clause is not protecting, I would say, those private funders. So we've looked at it. It's in the department, yes, presented this to Mintop last week. The second part, Chair, is about the institutional arrangement. The two views that have been put forward by the department on this one, and one is to top slice the capital component, to top slice the HSBC grant, that is the 18 billion rand that were dispersed to the provinces. and dispatch it directly to MHFC for MHFC to manage it. And then we enter into a delivery agreement with MHFC, and MHFC becomes accountable to the national department instead of becoming accountable to nine provinces. We've looked at that, and I think Minister will apply her mind on this one. Currently, the space program is not performing at the level that we wanted it to perform. And we are of the view that some of the provinces are not prioritizing this program. For instance, there were three provinces that didn't budget for it in the current financial year. I will not mention them here, but we are of the view that it cannot be treated as by way by provinces. So if provinces are not prioritizing, we might as well topsize the capital part and then disperse it to emergency. Minister is looking at it, and I think we'll take a decision soon as to how to administer this program.
Thank you very much. Obviously, we are not very comfortable with the FLIS program, but we've received the presentation, and obviously we will be making a follow-up on this issue, both from yourself and from the department itself. I think we still need more answers and more clarity on that program. But thank you very much for the presentation. We're going to go to the last presentation, which is Nature. People must ask us something to eat. While that is happening, Nature comes closer to the computer to present. And if people grab something to eat, it is done in such a way that it can disrupt the app. So that you have to finish in time. Just don't want people to collapse because I'm a slave driver. So just have something to eat, honorable baker. And then we can then do the last presentation. Unfortunately, we have had to bring the food inside because the street kids and people passing by, they decide they have to help themselves before the people in this house. I have to tell you, I just have to forgive us that we have to bring it in. Otherwise, by the time you go outside, the food will be finished. So that's what we did.
Can you confirm that so that there are no occasions?
I ask
him to verify. Yeah. Would mean that we must go to our office.
Okay.
Is there a link to open the
minister's
office now?
Yeah, I
need to go to the office. I'm asking you to verify. Yeah. Okay.
Well, the 50% of the people are sitting there, I think we can start. Letters can be sent to them.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair and members, and thanks for the opportunity to present the strategic plan of the APP. Our mandate, Chair, as would be well known by the committee, is to finance contractors and developers in the subsidy and affordable housing market, particularly on the supply side. And therefore, the purpose today is to appraise the committee of the strategy and the APP. Just to recap on the business of NETSHA, we are a direct financier, and therefore you would have heard from my colleagues that spoke before, that part of the business they do would be wholesale. For us, we do directly finance contractors and developers, and that's part of the evolution that NETSHA went through. And we are largely on short-term finance. We do affordable housing projects that would be delivered, say, on average within 24 months to deliver units, as well as financing contractors in the subsidy housing market. We also are not on the budget of the department unless from time to time the shareholder wants to strengthen the balance sheet. Therefore, we work on the budget principle where our income must really meet our operational costs. And therefore, the sources of income are interest and fees from lending, fees from program management support, as well as money market investments. Those are the main fees. Strategy is anchored on two pillars, Chair. One, it is to increase the impact that NETSHA is making in line with its mandate. And that in the five-year plan that has been refined to focus on affordable housing, increasing delivery in affordable housing and making efforts particularly to deliver more on the gap housing, under 400,000. Also, there are areas that are unserviced that require more demand, so we're part of the effort to drive lending initiatives in mining towns, and we provide finance on rental projects, provided we do the short-term finance part and have a taker finance that may come either from a commercial bank or from an agency that will take the mortgage loan from mortgage finance. Around subsidy housing, we have in the last four financial years, consolidated the performance of that area of the book and minimized the losses that we have seen in the past. So we're happy with stability in that area. But we are strengthening our work with provinces and municipalities to make sure that those risks that we've seen in the past are not seen repeated. We're also focusing on talking to our financing partners and financing partners in particularly with the drive in the NDP to increase densification, the inner city, better and efficient cities. It becomes important that we finance high density development, and we're talking to financiers like Future Growth, KDIC, DIC, so that they accept relaxation of our credit rules to accommodate those types of developments that drive high density. The other aspect that has fallen to the organization, and we have come around that aspect, is organizational sustainability. And we, in strategy, we want to continue with the positive results in financial performance of the company. And make sure that collaborations are again strongly driven with provinces and municipalities. This chair happens against an economic backdrop that defines the frame conditions. And I've mentioned the NDP and MTF targets that are outlined. But also economic factors, various economic factors will affect the performance of the strategy, sometimes negatively, but there are also positive elements that need to be considered in that. NHSC before me
put a model here of the supply side and the demand side. And we are pleased that there are some good aspects that are happening on the demand side over and above the programs like FLIS and all that have been outlined, with improvements that could be better performance in the market. But also in our engagements with TIC, we were pleased to see SA home loans, GTA has taken 60% of SA home loans, and they are driving SA home loans to approve in the gap market, and we are looking with all that development with interest. And there have been some collaborations with HIP, again, NCFC behind HIP in some of the developments that we've done in Prodia Glen, where we finance on the supply side, but the mortgages were issued by HIP, and we're starting to see collaborations in that area. But those are types of developments that you look at where the market, you see improvement in the functionality of the market. But there may be downsides in the market, like interest rates, affordability affected, and therefore impacting on the delivery of outputs. Around mining towns, we make a positive assumption around the intervention that we are making together with the Department of Human Settlements and other entities, that those will yield better performance of the market in those towns. That is, land release and planning will happen with big bulk infrastructure will be provided, therefore allowing developers to take root in those towns and be able to finance in that, and those assumptions that we have taken. Around financing capacity, I think that the end goal of the game of the DFI consultation is the one that we're looking at, where the DFI will be enabled both by the Act as well as instruments that will allow it to raise funding both from the public sector and the private sector, have a good mix, and therefore be able to make the impact. But in the interim, we have to work with the grants and the private sector that we're working with to do the best to deliver on this strategy until the consultation is completed. And therefore, if nature is to be understood, perhaps when you look at this core business, you would look at its lending business. We financing directly to developers and contractors, and the offer we make in affordable housing, we finance developments where they provide full title to end users or partial title, which would be called sectional title. And the attraction to this sectional title is the opportunity for densification, whereas full title you find that you finance, yes, in well-located areas, project lands, but you still see the development more on edges of the city. But when you want to consolidate and infill, the opportunities with the sectional titles, and those are the areas that we'll be looking at closely. And then we do program management, particularly structuring programs that will attract and incorporate and develop small and emerging contractors that cannot access finance on their own, and therefore risks need to be managed closely. We've done a number of programs in this, the poverty eradication program. We have been involved in KZN, in Free State, a number of provinces. If I were to summarize the targets that are in the strategy over the 5 years, in affordable housing, Chair, we're looking at financing in value of loans up to 1.7 billion rand. We would like to increase the number of projects that we finance over the MTSF pilot from 65 to 112, delivering 16,000 affordable housing units, which is a significant percentage when you look at how the country is producing in that area. And I think that with closer collaboration and the statistics that were presented here by NHGRC, we're going to be even refining the way we measure the sector performance around inspections that are done in that category of the market, where the no subsidy can be disaggregated further into affordable housing and beyond affordable housing. We would like to spread to other provinces, Chair, but we still think that our loan book will still be dominated by Gauteng, and therefore we will be looking at financing in other provinces in affordable housing. 40% of our loan book spread across other provinces. We're also looking and again, there's a big opportunity for collaboration around energy efficiency. And in this financial year, general financiers are starting to take serious
attention towards energy efficiency, and in this financial year we would want to adopt a measurement of our loan. And with NHGRC starting to reflect around energy efficiency issues, it will be easy to adopt those measurements. So let me know at any point in time a project that we are approving, how efficient it is, and the whole loan book and aggregate to that. We hope that in future we'll be able to put incentives to developers to develop and bring projects that are energy efficient. And then in subsidy housing, we increasing volumes, but also inclusiveness of our loan book by creating a relaxing some of the credit rules to allow smaller contractors, women and youth, to access finance and be able to participate in the economy. And that area is driven largely by how well we manage risk so that we minimize defaults. And then program management will then be supporting some of the priority areas that the sector has outlined under the leadership of the department, PhD projects, those projects that are intensive in developing women and youth and creating employment and do them in a programmatic fashion. And therefore, when translated in numbers of outputs, this table captures what we are looking at achieving in affordable housing, largely expressed in number of projects that we signed, and alternatively in units that come out of those projects. So over the period, we're looking at signing houses up to 16,000 for the MCSF period, which would translate in those number of projects that are outlined. Yes, for sustainability of the company, the loan values become important because that's where we generate our income in the loan book. Similarly, the structure in subsidy housing is about the number of projects and what we plan to deliver. And in this last proceeding, we have outlined that we want to increase that delivery over the 5 years. And the next breakdown is more the APT period quarterly performance for the year that year 15-16, and will be used as for monitoring purposes. As I indicated earlier, sir, that there are three questions that we always have to watch. Therefore, we watch the risks and the enablers. So the economic conditions are things that will affect our performance against the target. Also, our ability, we now starting the new round of marketing efforts across provinces. So on Friday, we are in the Free State. We're driving marketing in the Free State, and we do that roadshow across provinces. And in many respects, it will start to unravel the demand and activate the market. But we sit with the risk that if we were to exhaust our lending capacity, we may reach a point where we reject applications because there's so much that we can do. So we're managing our cash flows very closely, projects that are completing and therefore paying, so that we're able to take on new projects for funding, and a table later on will show this. We're also highlighting the management of the DFI process, and particularly areas of attention there is making sure that we carry the partners, the lending partners that we have that are in the private sector into the new DFI and future, and therefore the recognition and the risks and the anxieties of the financiers, we need to make sure that we talk to them and see the future as a positive future that they want to partner with, and that's one type that we want to look at. But also similarly with staff to drive a positive future about the DFI so that we don't lose the talent in the intervening period. And I think that as we drive change processes across the three organizations, it's going to be the common message that we need to drive across the institutions. Chair, I've just outlined the indicators of performance trends that are more historical. We've seen the importance of this slide, really. We've seen a restructuring of our loan where we see the dominance of affordable housing, and that's why we want to see nature going forward in the DFI. Dominance of affordable housing, and in that, particularly debt housing. This
slide deals with lending capacity, and effectively what we are saying that we've got 595 million to commit as nature funds against commitments that we have made of 644. So it may look like we've overcommitted. But because in some programs like subsidy housing, it's almost like revolving contractors draw and pay back and draw and pay back. And on average in the loan group, you'll find that the withdrawal against committed funds would be about 40%, and therefore that difference between 695 and 949 is that aspect, and our cash flows need to be then managed closely around that. It is when we get close to that 945 that we would then start to reject, depending on which stream of lending we are in. Around financial recovery and sustainability, this might just illustrate where the company comes from and the interventions that were made by the board around management. The mandate was get nature back to a sustainable platform. And I think that we have recovered well. We have reported some profits in the last financial year, looking at reporting some 7 million profits at the end of the financial year. And therefore, that area of financial sustainability is taken care of, but we need to keep our eye on it. These were projections on income coming from 2011, 2012 going forward around this, the income streams that are underpinned the business. Okay, Cindy Sanyos and our CFO will take us through the financials.
Thanks very much, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee. We are currently reporting or estimating a surplus of about 6.9 million for this current financial year. And we hope that surplus will continue to grow up to the 80 million in the year 2018. And the main contributors to that is the interest income which we earn on the loan that we are in grants, as well as the program management fee which we earn when we support various programs in various provinces. The challenge we still have is the level of write-offs or provisions which are as a result of diversion of funds. That is still a challenge with nature, even though we think it's under control at the moment. We are able to identify diversions and we take the appropriate action immediately. And I want to indicate that really going forward, we hope the provisions will start to decrease. We believe that everything is now under control. When it comes to balance sheets, the loan book continues to grow. In this financial year, we anticipate that it will be in the region of 407 million. It will drop in the next financial year. However, that drop is just a timing issue because it fluctuates from time to time. But yeah, in 2017-18, we think it will be in the region of 449 million. The cash on cash equivalent, even though it looks high, it includes an element of funds which we manage on behalf of the provinces that we are working with. And when it comes to liabilities, the FEDF loans, which is reported in the current financial year at 67 million, we will be repaying that figure. We applied as well for 500 million from the department, but we were only allocated 1 million, which is to be used fully to repay the FEDF loans. And you will also notice that the Hades facility as well as the KC facility is growing over the period. And that is because we believe our own funds will be fully utilized, and in that case we will be accessing funds from our funding partners. And those funds are not coming cheap, and it will affect our profit margin. Chairperson, I think the cash flow statement, I won't get into details, except to highlight that in 2015-16, the 61 million which we'll be getting from the department is reflected. and the loan disbursement to customers, we will continue to disperse more funds so that we can earn more interest on those funds. I think that's the highlight that we wanted to talk about.
I think that in the course of the presentation was highlighted sort of the frame conditions and the impact that we would want to make with the strategy. And we will observe those that report to the committee as the structure of the financial year. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Nesha. Honorable members, that's the presentation from Nesha. That's good. Yeah, no, I can see. No. I remember that week now. Honorable Stolle, are you still going to the public then? So I must start with you then. Honorable Stolle, Honorable Baker, Honorable Papa, Honorable Ghana, did you have your hand up? Okay. Honorable Ghana, Honorable Fani.
Thank you, Chairperson. First of all, we must commend the NACHA for the representation, but there's some questions that sometimes need some clarification. The first one, Chairperson, is the one of conventionally and student accommodation. How many have they constructed? And in which provinces, when they are talking about student accommodation? And the other one, Chairperson, is that their projection sometimes is too impressionable. When you check on page 24, slide 24, page 24, I don't know. The proper management fees, the statement of financial performance for the period of 2014-15 to 2013-18. In 2014-15 is 35 million, but in 2017-2018 is 58 million. Their position is some position, I believe they can just attack that one. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a big.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the same teach as the women of contractors or one of your fathers? Is what percentage of your contractors are actually women owned or majority women? And then with regards to finding alternative, viable alternative building solutions. Is that a growing trend, especially as you did mention the more energy efficient buildings and building solutions? Is there a growing trend, and are you more inclined to fund these? And I know companies who are trying to do the more greener developments battle to get financing from your traditional banks and stuff. So is there a growing trend in application that you got
those things? Thank you. Honorable Kappa. Thank you, Chair. I think my first one is linked to what Honorable Stolle was noting, that in presentation projections in that page 21, this is one, where the projections go a little bit down and go again. I missed the explanation there in the last year. Then the last one is maybe I think now Mr. Kweta must just educate me on this one of the assets and liabilities being that the equilibrium of the assets and liabilities.
I finished.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Chair. Just starting with this document, I think it's not the presentation. What I'm going to ask is in the document, not in the presentation. I was looking at the table. It makes for an interesting reading in terms of, I think this is a distribution of care between regular and non-performing loans. And then you have one run that goes from affordable housing. I'm not sure if that's correct, that NICA says it cannot collect one rent. I mean, I think this last day is close to that 50. But I'm not sure how your table is correct, but NICA is saying that it can't collect one rent. I don't know which contractor is actually owing NICA one rent. So if you could just look at the table, and if it's a typo, then you tell them. And my interest, especially from now, with the move from housing to human settlement, and then I read in here that you are trying to scale down on infrastructure and community facilities. And one of the issues that I have been raising is that we go into a place, all we do is just build the walls of houses, and then there are no public amenities. And then from nature side, you are saying your loans for people who want to involve themselves in the in that facilities, infrastructure and facilities side, you are scaling down. And it's a kind of a bit of a concern to me that in a way you will fund contractors that do houses, and then we do houses, but then we're not doing any community facilities or something to that effect. Because that's what the statement in here is saying. And I wanted to check with that, this contract, and the third question that you might want to ask, because this will be linked to your subsidy housing, that someone comes to borrow money, let's say someone has got a 10 million rand tender to build subsidy housing, and then comes to you and says, I want 3 million. The department, it's like, in a way, it's not aware, because I would expect that the prepayment of the contractors that are in the subsidy market should be as close to 100% as possible. Because it can't be that the department gives money, that 10 million in full to the contractor, and then it's now it's up to the contractor whether he or she pays nature. I think somewhere in there needs to be systems that talk to each other. We are giving you 10 million rand to build houses. You have worked nature to ask for 3 million rand. Because this is a short-term bridging finance, when we pay you, first, the best people to pay so that we can loan other people to pay nature, to make the money available to nature, so that people who get contracts for subsidy houses and for community amenities don't end up owing nature. Because if you look at your non-performing loan, your subsidy houses is quite high and your community amenities is high. And then these are people who get contact directly from government. And it's difficult to explain to me whether the systems are talking to each other, your national system and the department or the municipality, so that the collection in there should be high. You know, it's like me asking money from parliament as 100,000. First thing is that because the salary comes, the 5,000 must be taken off. And then the other one is around the project. It's my last question for the day, Chair. And your projections on the project that you want to do, especially in the subsidy housing. I'm not sure whether you're going through to a mega project as well as even though that's not in law. But then it seems like what the number of contracts that get signed and what gets budgeted. Because if you look, 2013, it was 24, and then the budget was 24, and then the actual difference. 2013-14, the budget was 26, the actual was 7. I just want to check whether you are moving away from your, you know, like your 50, 20 houses, which disadvantages, by the way, I would be the small guy who gets a contract to build 13 houses in your Limpopo VH compared to 1,000 houses that you can park in the Western Cape. How then do you marry the two? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Honourable Kurai.
Thanks, Chair Defendant. Let me also thank the President for the presentation. My question is brought because all the presentation from all the entities and the employees in the department. It's interesting how it's the only problem that everything is concentrated. Even today, the NACHAP says it has 40% for all the provinces. Even if Houghton gets 50%. Why Houghton always been so one problem that everyone is looking at? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'll try and take the questions as they came. The
first question was around rental and student accommodation. That's a new product that we have put on the map. But the limitation is, we do not have a trend in terms of reporting on that program. But we've financed a project in Gauteng. What it requires, whether it is conventional renting or student accommodation, is for a developer to come to us and say, I want to build this asset. And we finance the construction, the building of the facility. But their manner of repaying us should come from another financier who will take us out and pay us, and then they repay the bank on the income they draw from rental, which is a mortgage up rental that will be about 10 years. So that we've financed with NetBank, where we've constructed once we completed, and then NetBank take them out, and then they are serviced over 10 years. So that's how rental and student accommodation we're looking at. And that's, this is a better product that will work when we start to see synergies in the consolidation of DFI, where we have the long-term finance and the short-term finance in one house. The second one around program management, the projections, really the way that program management should be looked at is that our model is that we've got a small cost structure and we resource programs as they come. And therefore, when we project certain income and not missing, you see a corresponding reduction in cost. So there's always a direct relationship between income and cost that we invest on that. So we assume the volume that we will make. In the next financial year, we had projected that we would be on phase two of the poverty eradication program. So we built it in the program. But because of the shift of the function, we could not anticipate that would change. So it may look like we cannot project, but what you can rest assured is that there's always income versus cost that we manage those things so that we don't lock ourselves into high costs of running. There was a question around women contractors. I don't have the statistics, honorable member, with me now. But what I can just say, the statistics that I looked at are approval that we did in the financial year, that is 2014-15. In subsidy housing, we approved 112 million loans, and 62% of those were to women contractors. Now, those statistics is still on approval on our credit. 62% is approvals on our credit processes. But some of those loans have not been accepted by the contractor. So we are waiting to see what percentage has ultimately accepted us. But we were pleased by that approval rate. On alternative building systems, especially when we're talking energy efficiency, we're not just talking purely alternative. It may be conventional. Perhaps the way you build and finishes and all those aspects, we refactor them in the measurement of the efficiency of that build of that building or that house. But part of the question that you were raising, are we seeing more of alternative buildings? No. We're not seeing a growth in that. We financed some, the last one we financed was a bit relative, which went well. But we don't have influence on projects that come to us. What you find that the major influence there perhaps are three elements, are the banks and the actual end users, whether they are comfortable with the alternative building methods, whether it's based on perceptions or reality. And we've not seen growth in those areas, but we look them with interest when they do come in terms of financing. We've not seen many of them. There were also questions that were around, let me start with the one rent. We've adopted policy, as the board adopted a policy that says when we do write-offs, we write off to a rent. That's just for monitoring purposes. So that when we give up on collecting that, then it gets out of our office. So if we write off 3 million and still collecting, write it off to a rent. And does that just for monetary purposes, that is still in our book. So it's a deliberate way of monitoring where we've written off but still collecting. And that would reflect that. There's a question on infrastructure, which is a very valid question. We moved into infrastructure 2005, exactly about embracing human settlements concept. And you will see in the strategy that we're emphasizing close collaboration with provinces and municipalities. And our priority for this financial year is within the human settlements sector. But when you start to go into infrastructure, then you start to go to water and sanitation, public works, and all those elements, which brings a different type of dynamic. There are retentions there. There are variation orders. There are final accounts. That sometimes when they are poorly administered, the contractor goes down before they realize their money and as a result they default. And then we are stricter in our lending. We've not closed it down, but we're stricter in our lending in the infrastructure area. When we have certificate-only lending, it must have been expected, a certificate must have been produced so that they come and lend the certificate. That sort of protects us against those risks. Not 100%, but a significant amount of risks. On subsidy housing, we've got an instrument that we call irrevocable undertaking to pay, which is a risk instrument that is signed with the province. When we sign a loan, that contract must then present that to the province and it's signed. So there's an agreement that mitigates the risk because there's a dedicated account for that project where payments go. And that's what we want to strengthen. The closer we are to provinces and municipalities, the better it is for our officials to walk to that department and check something. When the risk arises is when then a contractor collaborates with an official to divert that money from coming into the account into another account. Then you call it diversion of funds. Then it becomes a fraudulent act and then we take legal processes around it. But we want to be proactive in managing in collaboration those risks before we get into litigation issues, and that's the drive for the current financial year and the years to come. Historical trends. We're coming from a restructuring of our business where we used to rely on intermediaries to mitigate risk. Now we finance directly, we manage our risk directly. So we've seen a dip in output as we strengthen, as we tightened credit rules. But with the projections and sort of our assumptions about the economic outlook going forward, if we're able to deal with critical things in mining towns and fast-growing towns, mega projects and small projects, there are no exclusions there, indicators and also issues of risk and financing by employers to employees, you see a market that is likely to improve in performance. Those are positive assumptions, and therefore we've made our projections on the basis of those assumptions that we're making. But we're not excluding small projects as well as mega projects. I think we are here to finance appropriately in both areas. There was a question on assets and liabilities. I just wanted to get clarity on that so that we're able to deal with it. Is it related to the balance budget? Yes. Or
sorry, Chapter Vicky. In fact, in 2 years. Let me speak to that. Yes, this is a balance sheet. I think ideally it should always balance. If it doesn't balance, it means something is wrong. I mean, that's always a concept that we emphasize on to make sure that your total assets are going to your total assets.
Thank you very much.
Just one question, and I don't know what happened to that slide. There was a question that was raised around dominance of public. And I think that Just the nature of the economy, you likely to find our gang dominating, particularly in the area of affordable housing, because the migration patterns and the demand, you see higher demand in affordable housing in Gauteng than the other parts. But also, the other factor that I find critical is that the concentration of developers. Some of the smaller municipalities that are far from Gauteng, developers are not keen to go and initiate projects in those areas, which is an area perhaps when you start to see when you're making the interventions like in mining towns, where you look at the capacity of the municipality, ability to do planning and all those elements, then the ability to attract developers. But when you look at subsidy housing, actually Gauteng is not dominant. The most dominant province you would be KZN, Eastern Cape, in subsidy housing. And Gauteng is not big in that area. It's actually the outlying provinces that are dominant in that area. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That takes care of the business of the day. The four presentations that we were supposed to get today, we've got clarities. We still left with four more that we must do this afternoon. We're going to take a 30-minute break and then we come back and we do the rest of the four. Honorable member. thank you very much. Tomorrow we're starting at 9. So that at least you don't get to this time so exhausted. We're going to try to start at 9 tomorrow, so that at least you feel fresh by the time we get to the last presentation. We were trying to gauge the interest and the... So we know that now tomorrow we must start at 9. Thank you very much. Thank you very much to the entities that presented today. Thank you to the honorable members. You, despite the fact that it's a very growing schedule, you really are doing your best. Tomorrow is last day. Hang on there. We are almost at the end. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Don't get lost tomorrow. Venue tomorrow is V227. Eh?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
V227.
No, I came yesterday.
Oh, okay.